Thank you very much, Mr. Marconi. We'll go to delegations first, and I'm starting a list here of commissioners that have questions. Mr. Jan Lamb, please. Thank you. Come on up. I believe everybody on the commission received a copy of your presentation, and it looks very well thought out, so thank you very much for sending that in to us ahead of time. So, whenever you're ready.
Morning. Thank you for allowing me to speak. There are two topics of interest that I would like to raise concerning the service changes in the Orleans area following the October 6th bus network changes. One, bus stop assignments at Plaster Orleans Station. Two, service levels on Route 39. I'll start with bus stop assignments at Plaster Orleans. Prior to October 6th, any customers wishing to travel west to Blair Station and beyond would wait at stop 2A, what was then routes 91, 95, 103, and 104. Following the bus route changes on October 6th, customers would use rapid route, Route 39, at stop 2A. Along with that, several local routes from Orleans were modified to extend to Blair after servicing Plaster Orleans that follows the exact same routing as Route 39. They are routes 33, 35, and 37. These three other routes have been given different bus stop assignments instead of being assigned to stop 2A. Examples, Route 35 has been assigned stop 2C, and routes 33 and 37 has been assigned stop 1C, which is an off-only bus stop. Furthermore, bus stop flag 1C does not have routes 33 and 37 advertised. I'm raising the issue of bus stop assignments for routes 33, 35, and 37 is because Route 39 only operates every 30 minutes during off-peak and weekends. Passengers whose local routes do not extend to Blair are required to transfer at Plaster Orleans for Route 39. Given that Route 39 only operates at 30-minute service during off-peak and weekends, if there are any other routes that shows up at Plaster Orleans Station that continues to Blair, such as routes 33, 35, and 37, users will take it. As a result, the current bus stop assignments at Plaster Orleans, I have seen customers that would have been waiting for a Route 39 Blair at stop 2A frantically running to stop 2C whenever Route 35 arrives into Plaster Orleans. For routes 33 and 37 Blair, I have seen inconsistencies in where bus operators actually service the bus stop at Plaster Orleans, despite stop 1C being the assigned stop for pickups. Some use stop 2A, some use stop 2C, and some loop around the station platform and either use stops 1A and 1B. In my opinion, the bus stop assignments at Plaster Orleans for routes 33, 35, and 37 being scattered all over the place makes no sense, considering the 30-minute frequency on Route 39 during the off-peak and weekends. I am requesting the Transit Commission to ask OC Transpo to review the bus stop assignments at Plaster Orleans. My recommendation is to have routes 33, 35, 37 Blair all assigned to use stop 2A before continuing west to Blair. By doing so, this will allow customers at Plaster Orleans to use other bus routes as an alternate to Route 39 without having to run from stop to stop within the station chasing after another bus that follows the exact same routing as Route 39. This should not be a complicated request. Service levels on Route 39. I will deviate from my original proposed remarks and state the following. Since the October 6th changes in issue with Route 39, The issue with Route 39 was the 30-minute frequency for weekdays and off-peak and weekends between Blair and Trim on weekdays and on weekends between Blair and Plaster Orleans. I have seen the winter service change published this week, and I am happy to see the service being increased to 15 minutes. It is a good start, and I'm thanking OC Transpo for doing so. My personal preference would have been a frequency of every 10 minutes. However, 15-minute frequency is better than 30 minutes. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions of the delegation? Sarah? Commissioner Wright-Gilbert?
It's fine. Sarah's fine. It's actually a question for staff on something that the delegation said. I'm unclear on the rules. Just delegation? Okay, then that's fine. I'll ask staff after. Thank you. Thank you, though, for presenting. I actually do take the bus from Place d'Orleans every day, so I absolutely know what you're talking about when you talk about the different stops. So thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
Commissioner Olson.
Thank you, Chair. Just, Mr. Lamb, the changes that you noted about the 39 service change, going from half-hour service to every 15-minute service, is that what is the time? I didn't see the actual published service change.
Sorry, I didn't hear that?
When is it effective, but for what times of the day is it going from 30 minutes, every 30 minutes, to every 15 minutes?
Well, according to the service change, it would be during the off-peak, so outside of rush hour. I understand they'll continue running frequent service during the rush hour, but during the off-peak, the frequency increased from 30 to 15 along certain sections between Blair and Trim during the weekdays and between Blair and Place d'Orleans during the weekends, while maintaining the existing 30-minute service to and from Millennium. That's what I understand.
Okay. Mr. Scrimger, do you want to add anything to this? Because I believe you're working on something like this for Councillor Luloff on these routes.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The point about an opportunity to improve the stop assignments at Place d'Orleans Station is something we're working on. We haven't got our plan finalized yet. We're looking at a number of aspects, many of which are the ones that Mr. Lamb mentioned. As we've just talked about, as we'll have available to everyone in the memo, we've got major service increases on Route 39 that follow the initial observations of how things were working once the network service change came into place in October and the priorities that were set by the councillors. So we've got an earlier westbound trip in the morning. We're increasing westbound service in the morning rush hour from every 7 to 8 minutes to every 6 minutes. Eastbound service leaving Blair Station from every 7 to 8 minutes to every 6 minutes. And as Mr. Lamb mentioned, increasing service from every 30 minutes to every 15 minutes. Eastbound in the morning, westbound in the afternoon, through the midday evening, Saturdays and Sundays. We're also making other adjustments to make sure that the scheduled running time along the route is appropriate and that there's enough recovery time to make sure that trips are better able to leave on time. So there's many changes and improvements on Route 39. And they all start on Sunday, January 5th.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Scrimger, and thank you, Mr. Lamb. I know you have a lot of fans at OC Transpo for the well-thought-out suggestions that you send in, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next allegation will be David Jeans for Transport Action.
Hello, John. Thank you, Chair. Sorry I don't have a written presentation, but that's one of the consequences of responding to a verbal presentation without having seen the material before. On a positive note, I'm certainly very glad to see the improvements in availability that have been reported and the progress on some of the remedial actions. I will say that, it's taken rather a long time to deal with the missing strap problem. I think this should have been anticipated. I was in Toronto 2 weeks ago, and all the new streetcars operating in Toronto, all of the new subway trains have a large number of straps installed, and I think that A should have been anticipated earlier, and perhaps a way should have been found to respond to it sooner, because the consequence of that is that people are clustering close to the doors. There are lots of vertical stanchions to hold on to at the door, including that triple one that's right in the middle of the area. You want people to move away from that area and not congest the doors. That's creating problems for people who are trying to get off the trains, and I think that's one of the significant contributors to people's behavior in dealing with the doors. I did notice during the testing period that the dwell times at the stations, this is when the trains were doing the run-in prior to service, that the actual dwell times at stations were unrealistically short. And again, I think that is a significant contributor. We've been talking a lot about recovery time, particularly as it relates to bus drivers, but I think recovery time for the trains is also very significant. We've been shown by the drives in circles tweets that have come out from OC Transpo itself that once a train is delayed, because the turnaround times at the terminals are so short, only 2 minutes, it's only possible to recover at best about a minute per end-to-end trip in terms of getting the trains back on schedule. OC Transpo in its live tweets uses the term residual delays very, very extensively. There's no definition of what a residual delay is, but my observation is that those are gaps between the trains that can continue for up to an hour or more before they can be got back onto a normal service frequency. That would not be so much of a problem if the 14th train was running. The 14th train on the same frequency would give them an extra 4 minutes per round trip, approximately, that could then be used to smooth out some of these delays more quickly. With respect to those delays, the terms used on the tweets include slight delays, minimal delays, significant delays, delays unqualified. What we hear is that really the threshold that is viewed as being the difference between a minor delay and a more significant delay is 5 minutes. I do want to point out that a delay of 5 minutes between trains is equivalent to a canceled train, or when you're supposed to be running a train every 4 to 5 minutes, and that's equivalent to 6 or 10 canceled bus trips because of the train's larger capacity. The consequences of this are several. One is that in the morning, that directly contributes to the really extreme platform congestion we've been seeing, particularly at Tunney's. In the afternoon, it contributes to buses heading out to the suburbs without full loads because the trains have not been arriving to deliver the people needed to fill those buses. And in the worst case, there have been a lot of tweets from passengers who, because of these residual delays, have missed their last bus of the peak back to their suburban destination. So I think all of those factors have to be looked at. I'm glad that OC Transpo is making progress. It'll be obviously much better once all the platform markings are installed, all the straps are installed. Customers are less pressed to maintain their balance and get to and from the doors. And also information maybe is a little bit clearer about the impact and duration of some of the delays that are being reported by the live tweets. I just had a couple of other things. Measuring availability by the number of kilometers that the trains do during the day is not necessarily reflecting what availability is really like during the particular peak hours where it's most important. Measuring ridership by monthly pass sales, which was something Mr. Scrimger mentioned at a previous meeting, may not be that reliable, particularly since a lot of people won't be buying passes anyway for the holiday period who normally do. I think that any measures that increase the clarity of the system's performance for the benefit of the Commission and the public are to be welcomed. So those are my comments for the moment, and I wish OC Transpo every success in improving the service reliability both on the buses and the trains.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jean, for all those thoughtful suggestions. Is there any questions for the delegation? We're good? Okay, thank you very much for coming in today, and I'm sure we'll see you at the February meeting. The last delegation is Lise Pascal and Manico. Thank you. You wouldn't believe how small they wrote that. Sorry about that.
Je veux commencer par remercier tout le monde. Merci au Citransport pour votre travail. Merci aux conseillers municipaux pour votre dédication et votre engagement. Merci aux membres de la communauté ici présents pour votre présence. Alors, je veux aussi remercier mon conseiller municipal, Stéphane Blé, pour son travail constant et acharné auprès de ses commettants, nous les résidents d'Orléans-Cumberland. Mais je suis ici en tant qu'un des leaders, one of the leaders of the Alliance des Burundais du Canada, Alliance of Burundians of Canada in Orleans. And I'm here to bring one of our main issues regarding transit. Et c'est à propos de... du service d'autobus, basse frequency et le temps d'attente entre les bus de relais. Alors, en ce qui concerne le premier point du service d'autobus, I want to advocate for the improvement on the frequency of the buses, not only for public servants, because we think that in Orleans we have the majority of the residents of, you know, have a 9-to-5 job, right? But for residents who have jobs and shifts that aren't 9-to-5. Et c'est dommage que c'est la nuit que les bus sont les moins fréquents lorsque c'est là où le danger nous guette le plus. Aussi, à Orléans, à Place d'Orléans, during weekends, the wait time and bus frequency is unbelievable. Are we being punished for not having cars? Some members of the community asked me. Waiting 1 hour or more out in the cold in bus shelters that are not well heated is really painful. For safety reasons, especially when talking about women's safety, I'm a member of the Women's March Ottawa Executive Committee, and this is an important issue for me to apply the gender lenses. And I also have coordinated the Take Back the Night's March, La Rue, La Nuit, Les Femmes Sans Peur. Je pense que c'est important de penser en profondeur à cette problématique. Et moi aussi, en prenant le bus, je me suis sentie des fois en danger, souvent, la nuit, à attendre le bus, tu sais, pendant plus de 30 minutes. Des fois, t'arrives là, le bus est déjà parti, tu dois attendre une heure pour que le prochain bus puisse arriver. Je sais que votre budget est peut-être contraint. I'm very aware that your budget is tight, but please consider this issue. And so it might not happen very soon, I'm very aware of that, but I'm going to the next topic. My second subject is le temps d'attente entre les bus. And I might have a suggestion. Here's what I'd like to suggest in order to tackle the issue of complaints related to long wait at bus stations. Scheduling is the key here. Why don't you keep the same number of trips, but make them coordinate better so that one bus pulls in, the transfer bus hasn't left yet, so you don't have to wait the entire time, the entire gap. In other words, ensure that feeder routes will be timed with the departure of rapid transit routes, 96, 97, 99, etc., so that riders do not have a long wait in dark places, especially in the cold weather, and are able to quickly get to their destination. Thank you very much. Merci beaucoup.
Thank you very much for coming in. Is there any questions to the delegation? Councillor Kavanaugh?
Oops. Merci beaucoup pour votre question. I really appreciate the fact that you're raising gender equity because that is a concern. And if it means women are feeling afraid and waiting a long time at bus stops, we should hear about it. So yes. I appreciate coming forward today. Do you think this is happening in Orleans at the Orleans station?
It's not only happening in Orleans. I think it's everywhere in Ottawa. I'm just saying in Orleans because one of the leaders of the community, the Burundian community in Orleans, I'm bringing up issues that were brought up to me. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to speak to all of Ottawa, but I'm very aware sitting at committees on women's rights, I'm aware of that is a citywide issue.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Thank you for raising it. Merci.
Thank you very much for your work. I know that you are a gender woman, equity advocate, and I really appreciate what you do.
Thank you.
Yes.
Anybody else? Oh, okay, thank you very much for coming in today.
Merci beaucoup.
So now we'll start with questions to staff, and I've got a list already started here. So first up will be Councillor Tierney, followed by Councillor Kavanaugh, followed by Councillor Brockington.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for the presentation today, John and your team. First of all, cancellation-wise, Riley and I remember last year very well. It was a living hell, and I think I brought it up several times. I'm noticing on many of the routes that were really affected last year, it is better this year. But overall, we're hearing many, many reports over the last couple of days about cancellations. I had a gentleman on Twitter named Eric. He had 90 minutes to get to work today because of cancellations. Can you provide some context and comment? Is this an annual, like Christmas? This always happens this time of the year? And if so, if that's the case, how are we going to fix it in the future? Because, you know, holidays aside, we still have ridership, and, you know, they need to take the bus to get to work.
Yeah, we're having some very good days. We're having some challenging days, and I'll separate weekdays from weekends. And what's important to share with committee is what's causing the cancellations. And, you know, we can all agree that if there's a storm or if there's breakdowns, mechanical issues, you know, that list of things, everybody can accept those. Nothing against the operators. The operator shortage is a challenge, and I want to talk about why that is. There's multiple things that is causing that. First and foremost, I hope everybody appreciated the graph dating back to 2015. The team is exhausted. The operators have been working very, very long, difficult, multi-year challenges out there. And the delay in the launch of the train was painful for all of you. Remember the route adjustments that we did and then couldn't pull them back? So for every one of those moves, it's exponentially more stressful for those operators because, remember, we've put out a bunch of mitigation measures, overtime, giving up vacation. By the way, CFRA just posted something. We're doing even more of that for the new year, which speaks to the second part of your question, Councillor. What are we going to do to prop up the operation? So why are we short drivers? You can put out as much overtime as you want right now. People are exhausted. They've been working their entire summer. They've been going multi-year. They've given up vacations and so forth. It's that time of the year where they want some time with their family and so forth. So it's not because they don't care about the customers, they don't care about the organization. They're tired. They've been doing a phenomenal job. The 40 extra buses that we deployed plus the 20, and by the way, for every bus you put out there, it's two for one, so your two drivers are being dedicated to that. So that's about 120 drivers that are on that piece. The plan always was, because that's come up, you know, so how do we get to where we are? The plan was always to do the major service change when we launched the train. And remember, we kept saying it was going to be difficult, the biggest service change in the history of us. And nobody at this table and nobody in planning and, you know, all our discussions with operators, unions, and supervisors through all that planning, nobody thought it was going to be perfect. You don't change one of the busiest systems in North America overnight and not expect changes. So, you know, when you look back, and it's always easy to look back, it was implement the service. We knew we were tabling the $7.5 million in the budget to do adjustments to address the issues. We didn't plan on the high level of disruptions, and you look at that chart, remember we're pulling all your buses off your main routes and so forth. We didn't anticipate we're going to have to do a dedicated 20 fleet. You know, it pains me to watch those buses sitting there where we could be serving customers. They're just sitting there waiting as a backup. That wasn't part of the plan. It was a mitigation measure which we've had to put in. We are where we are. And then the other piece, if you look at your budget, there's a big bump in drivers. And that's because the federal government changed the Canadian Labor Code on us in the summer. And September 1st, every single person that works at OC Transpo, federally regulated, is entitled up to 3 paid days off and 2 additional non-paid days off. To date, we've lost 1,400 person days of people exercising that right from September 1st. To date, 1,400 person days. And our operators, the union, management have been working tirelessly to bring people in on overtime and shift arrangements, buying out vacations, and so forth. Your budget that you approved, if you look at the FTE counts, and I didn't get one question on that, I was a little bit surprised about it, it's not just for the new service. You're paying to backfill the new changes to the labor code. So everybody's asking me, why are you hiring so late? The hiring of those people were for the new year. But when you compound the 40, the 20, and the impact of the labor code, we are where we are. And, you know, credit to staff. We've had some amazing days on bus service, but there's challenging days. And on weekends, it's difficult. We're struggling to get more operators in. It's not because they don't care or don't want to. They're maxed out. So we accelerated the hiring process. We were assuming you were going to approve the budget. We did a posting. The first time in the history of OC Transport, we had to rent out an arena to bring in hundreds of applicants. And we have, on December 23rd, the training department is taking, they're not taking holidays. They're working every 6 days out of seven, training up 23 of those new operators every 36 days. And by June, we'll have 100 additional operators. In the meantime, that's, you know, what CFRA is tweeting out right now. We're saying, okay, hands up, who would like to give up their vacations because we want to deliver your January service?
So, thank you, John.
It's the perfect storm, and it's not excuses. I'm just putting it all out there. And on recovery time and the piece for the employees, you saw the $1.7 million investment. And, you know, that, if you want to get into that piece, that's all about the contract, the binding arbitration that we have and how that works. And, you know, we're hearing about, well, more recovery time, more frequency of service. So, as I said in my interview, it's not a bottomless pit. I'd love to solve everybody's issue, but it's fares, taxes, or service.
Well, thank you. Clearly, you're passionate about it, and I understand that. And so just again, real quick, compared to last year, I remember last year we had a lot of issues, and I think it was more about the fact we were getting to the point of light rail. We weren't there yet. And there was a lot of cancellations. There was people calling in sick. There was, from my perspective, they were concerned that they were losing their jobs, so they were cashing out as many days as they could because back then we were going to lay people off. This year, it's a little bit different. We have the certainty. We know we're keeping people on. Are people calling in sick? Or are people just, like you, I think you've explained it well, people are exhausted. We can't have this next year, so how do we better prepare? How do we give you the tools? Do we have to go back and say even more FTEs are required to be able to solve these issues? Because frankly, if people are taking on too many hours, now we need more drivers to satisfy those, you know, weekends, the holiday periods. It seems that's the issues for a lot of these operators, which do great work, but we need them.
You've done great things with your budget. That pot of money does one critical thing that will help us all. And yes, operators, just like everybody else, are getting sick, and mechanics and so forth. But what we need to do is to build up the spare board. And the spare board, and that's why we're not going to stop at the 100 hirings. We're going to hire more so that you always have spare operators so that if someone calls in sick, you have the other person that can take that run or take that shift and so forth. And again, those are the very, you know, good discussions we've had with the union. The union's been saying for years, you know, your spare board is getting shorter and shorter. I think the other part that everybody's forgotten is not one single person lost their job in the transition of LRT. And that was a strategic goal that everybody wanted, that we didn't want to send hundreds of people home. There was could have been potentially 600 people going home telling their loved ones that they lost their job. Nobody lost their job. The threat of downsizing affected recruits. We seem to be having a good crop of recruits. So to answer your question, Councillor, the money that we've got in there, we were also going to build up our spare board. We're building up the recovery time that's been talked about in the last week. And so, but it's going to take some time. And in the meantime, we're getting very innovative with those mitigation measures and so forth, which a lot of them are very expensive, and we're tracking every single one of them. And this is going back to RTG. That's our position, that we are in this difficult position because of the narrative that I've just given you.
Okay, good. So I'm happy to hear that, and I assume you continue to work with the unions, which there's been a couple of operators. How many operators do we have in the ATU?
There's about 1,500.
Okay, so out of the 1,500, and you know, we have a few that are coming forward now, and there's fear of reprisal, all that sort of stuff. I get that. Who controls the discussions for that 1,500 people? It's the union, the president of the union, I assume. They speak as one voice when it comes to not only issues of concern for grieving positions, but they also speak for salaries. Would that be the correct assumption? There is a policy and a procedure that these things must be followed up on?
There is.
Okay. Well, I have a lot of operators in my area, and I'll tell you right now, as a counselor, I've actually had some come to me and say to me, well, I was supposed to get this next position, and it's pretty clear that I say, well, you'll have to go through your union. That is the procedures that you must go through if you feel that there is an issue with that. It protects counselors because you don't want interference from that perspective. But I've heard that a few times. Is that what takes place? They go to the union heads and say, I should have received this position. I know we're getting really into the weeds here, but I think that's been floated around in a couple of stories, and I'd like a little clarity on it.
There's multiple avenues for anybody to take their issues. They can go to their supervisor managers. They also have what are called section heads. So there's the 1,500 operators are grouped into clusters of hundreds. They have a dedicated section head that is there to look after their issues, support them, disciplinary issues, and so forth. There's the Let's Talk group, which you can go as an operator to speak to. We have an open door policy. I know that's an overused term, but I can tell you I speak to hundreds of operators regularly. So does everybody on this management team. And so you've got multiple avenues to take your issues through.
And you feel confident with the union and the process, how it's laid out right now? In the case of the individual that came forward, what's the union's position on that? Because they're supposed to speak as one voice.
I don't want to speak on behalf of the union. And I'm the elephant in the room is, you know, am I upset about this individual? I'm not upset with this individual. I'm not. My issue is, I checked. Who did you speak to about your, you know, I could understand if you went to every manager and every supervisor and a section head and so forth and got told, go away. But it didn't go that way. And I'm not upset. And I will speak to him. And I will try to understand the issue. What I'm telling you, I will tell him the exact same thing. I would love to give. And by the way, there's hundreds of operators right now that are not happy on their run. They would love to have more recovery time. There's also hundreds that have great recovery time. And by the way, seniority rules, and you can bid for those jobs.
Right.
And by the way, if you were on a dedicated BRT run, you were fine with recovery time. If you operate the 6, Councillor Menard, you're late the minute you start. Your recovery time is not very good on the 6. There's a bunch of those routes. And it's a very difficult job. We tell them all this. If you're the junior operator, there's going to be a few years where you're not going to have the best run.
Great.
And it's very difficult. And by the way, on the recovery time, that's another word for can we have fixed breaks? They don't have fixed breaks. That's a collective agreement. I can't change that. And I encourage people to look at the arbitration ruling from that horrible 51-day strike. It was lose-lose.
I remember it quite clearly. So on that note, I'll leave it at that. I think there's an appropriate process in place. Sure, some people might not like it, but it's the one they agree to, just like I don't want to negotiate salaries individually with operators. I think we have to allow those policies to really take hold. I'll switch gears for a second here. Light rail. We had this discussion last meeting about now we're getting in the off-peak. You see the students, they're finishing exams, they're tooling down. Government workers, let's face it, are all calling in sick Friday, except for Sarah. That being said, you'll notice the loads are decreasing. I've seen it. I've been on the train and the bus quite a bit lately. They're slowing down. Are the trains still running full steam ahead with RTG like they're the real world? So we can keep the testing going during that, I'm saying 2 to 3 week period when it's lighter loads, we want to get those bugs worked out now. Are they still running full steam ahead?
Are you speaking about the additional trains, Councillor?
I'm talking about our Line 1 service and making sure it's running like it's a business week work day with all the trains connected, with all the carts out that we usually have out, not slowing down for the holiday schedule. I asked that last time, and it seemed that was the case. They were going to keep going full steam ahead, not taking a break for the holidays, because our ridership needs this system in January, and it'd be better if it comes back that much better.
Absolutely, Councillor, and it's full schedule. There's the adjustments for the holiday periods, but no, there's no changes to the plan.
Great. I'll keep my next couple of questions super brief because I'm hogging all the time here, but short story is there was a report of doors falling off to the operator cab in one of the trains. I assume that's not the exterior doors. This is the interior plastic doors, and maybe you can explain what happened there.
Yes, Mr. Chair. it was one of the interior doors. It was one of the interior doors to the operator cab. We have been able to look into it and what happened. It's been the first occurrence. We were able to confirm through the CCTV camera footage that it appears that there was a group of individuals, a couple of them appear to be intoxicated, and fell quite hard into that door. But it was an interior door inside the train, and that's what caused it to break. So when the operator went to open the door next, that's when it came off its hinge.
Oh, okay. And they are just little plastic doors, which is fine. And we assume there's enough security for the operators with those little plastic doors?
Yes, I mean, they're specifically designed for this purpose. They are very robust. It was actually a very, very hard hit on that door. And as I said, it's been an isolated occurrence.
Okay. So there was also talks, there was an eight-hour delay from one of the reporters mentioned that. I'm just curious, what kind of delay happened because the door broke? Like, was the train disabled and it just had to stay there?
Mr. Chair, I don't know all the specifics to it, but there was a delay in that the train wasn't able to continue in service with passengers.
Okay.
So we would have left the train at that platform. I believe it was Blair Station at the time.
Yeah.
We would have left it there until there was an appropriate time to take it off. Now, customers at that station would have been asked to get off that train and board the next one, which would have been a couple minutes later, 3 to 4 minutes later. That train may have sat there for a period of time until we removed it, but there wouldn't have been any further impact to service other than that initial delay from customers having to transfer from one train to another.
Great, thank you. So I have two quick questions because I'm getting the hook here from the chair. The R1 service, just to confirm, it is now stopping at Sevierville and when it's been in use at this point?
Yes, it would. I think it's only run once since that change was made, however.
Okay, great. And again, I want to thank Pat. We've had a couple of great discussions about using Sevierville Station where there's currently no buses. And the R1 service is the first test of it, which I think the R1 ridership will enjoy. It's much more comforting not have to walk 800 meters. But I want to thank you for working with myself and Councillor Dudas at possible opportunities, which we consult with the public. We're not going to change anything, where we can make use of that Sevierville platform for two or three routes to make it a little more effective and release the crush of people at Blair Station. My last question is related to e-wallets. It used to be set to about 2-hour time windows in the past. Now it's reduced to 1.5 hours. I'm just wondering, have we noticed any impacts on that? Because, you know, I see somebody that had a 90-minute delay today. If it gets into 91 minutes and, you know, they're outside the fair paid zone and they have to tap again, have we experienced any challenges with that? Is that something we have to review and maybe put it back to 2 hours?
Mr. Chair, it hasn't ever been 2 hours in Ottawa. It's been 90 minutes since that policy was adopted in the late 80s.
Okay.
It's 90 minutes most times a day. It's 105 minutes, so an extra quarter hour evenings and I think Sundays. I don't remember the detail. We have had a couple of comments from customers who said they weren't able to complete their last trip before they... validation expired. I don't think we've heard of one yet left behind at a fare gate, because the fare gates are generally in the middle of the city. So
right.
As the O train gets longer, that may in future years it may come up, and we're always ready to assist any customer who has trouble. If they have trouble at the fare gate, we have the customer help points built into the ticket machines, and we're always happy to resolve any problem that customers have had. I think we've heard about one or two people October who've been automatically charged an extra fare because their last connection onto a bus was later than it should have been because of a delay, and so we just reversed that charge for them.
Great, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Councillor Tierney. And I think we should acknowledge that after all that discussion about the union, I think we should acknowledge that the president of the union's here in the room today and has been a full partner with Mr. Manconi and his team in working out a lot of these issues. And so on behalf of the commission, I want to thank you for your work on that. Councillor Kavanaugh.
Thank you very much. And first of all, I want to thank you for all your efforts in in attacking these issues that keep coming up. It is a new train system, and it was bound to have bumps, and it did. And I see that they're getting looked into. I would have recommended perhaps maybe a more of an overlap with the bus service, but it is what it is. It was just 3 weeks, and so therefore it took people just didn't get used to it fast enough, and hence door problems and stuff. I wanted to ask you about this this labor code change, which came into September 1st. You were saying how big an impact it had on hiring in terms of the hours and stuff. How much lead-up time did you have? Because we had the launch just a couple weeks later.
The changes to provisions of the Canada Labor Code had been discussed for a period of time, but there was never an effective date that was provided to it. And then we were given notice sometime in the summer, I can get you that exact date, that effective September 1st, these new provisions would be in place. So it was very little lead-up time to prepare in advance, and definitely there was zero lead-up time for us to be able to increase staffing or make any adjustments to that effect to deal with an increased entitlement for time off.
So you weren't able to take that into consideration when we decided on the launch of the LRT system, because it would have had an impact, I expect.
That is correct. We did not have the opportunity to take that into consideration.
Okay, because it seems rather close in time period. The concerns that I hear most of is not about the LRT. It's about bus service. It's about frequency. It's about missing buses. And I appreciate Mr. Scrimger coming to my office and talking to me about it. And I've repeatedly said that, you know, that first load of 40 buses did not address the concerns I heard from the residents. But I believe that we're going to get some more buses in January for routes like 87 and 57, which are the ones I hear the absolute most about, though I do hear about other ones. I think one of the biggest concerns is the communications, and we've heard about how we know how many cancellations there was, and it was not the ones that were advertised. How can we do better in communicating cancellations? Do you need more staff in communications? Because you were talking about, I saw the slides about it just couldn't do it fast enough. Is there a need for more communication staff? Because this is really important information. We hear about people having to wait in the cold for, you know, half hour, an hour. If they have that knowledge, they can make other plans. But what can you do to get that information to people very quickly?
Mr. Chair, the first thing that we are doing, and we've begun this already, is to remind people that the automated information systems are always up to date under the most reliable source. So using the iPhone app, using one of the many independent apps that use the open data, calling the 560-1000 will always get you the most information, the most up-to-date information about when your bus is going to arrive. The second is that Council did approve more customer support staff in the 2020 budget, and we'll be using them to bolster our strength at providing customized live information updates through all the channels.
You're telling me this, but people are still telling me that they're not getting the information, so clearly there's some sort of a disconnect here. Is it possible we can do better on this because they're not getting the information? Can we have it so that if they have an app that they can get an information, they look up their bus number, their route, and it says this bus is canceled, this one got canceled, so they can go, okay, I'm going to try the other route or something along that line? Because in this day and age, we talked about this, and you sent me some information about GPS service. There's still missing links in terms of people getting the information. People have been telling me, well, yeah, you give a list of the cancellations, but it's a whole big long list, and I have to find my route. Why isn't there a way so that they can do it quickly and have that information on their particular route when they're standing at a bus stop and wondering, where's that bus? Can we do better in terms of GPSs and apps?
Mr. Chair, every one of our customers is obviously making a different trip, and many customers receive that information and want to receive that information different ways. The information that we provide on the app, on the screens, on the phone system, and on the open data is, when is your next trip going to come? So it's not this trip has been canceled, it's that this will be your next trip. That's available all the time for everybody, but that's not in all cases the way everyone wants to consume the data. Some people would like to hear about the exceptions rather than the than what's going to happen next. There's a wide range of independent apps out there, which all for iPhones, Androids, and for the web, which provide the information in different ways. We've got a library to all of those apps, so that people can try different ones, find the one that works for the way they want to receive the data. I have only two on my phone. I use the OC Transpo iPhone app first of all, but when there's specific things I want to look into deeper than our own app provides, I use the Transit app. Other people use BusBuddy, OC Transpo, Bus Tracker. There's many apps, and people can choose the one that provides the information that they find best suits them.
But can we have it tell us that the bus is canceled? Because that's the thing that I'm hearing that they don't know about.
That's the one thing that is still sent manually. And that's what we do through our email subscription, our text subscription on the web page, and also through the two Twitter accounts, OC Transpo Live and OC Transpo Direct.
Like I said, that they're getting a stream of information. Can they get something more immediate where they're standing at a bus stop and they're looking for their bus and they can tie it in right away on an app? Is that possible?
For the most part, that information is all available.
Okay, I guess there's still a disconnect because that's not what I'm hearing. People are not getting the information fast enough. I'll move on to the information about absenteeism. Clearly, there's issues if there's missing buses. What is the level of absenteeism? Is it the industry norm or is it above average?
I don't have the latest figures. I know it is high. It was very, very high. Mr. Charter might have the last Q4 or Q2 results on that.
Yeah, it does fluctuate from day to day and from week to week, but we're anywhere in that 15 to 19% range for an absenteeism rate.
15 to 19%. What's the industry average? I should know that, but I don't have it here. Is that considered above average?
I would have to check myself. I think that's probably fairly in line, but you need to keep in mind that across the industry, there's very, very different terms and conditions that employees, the entitlements they have are very, very different. In one area, you can see a lower number, but their entitlements to certain leave provisions are much, much different than what we would have here. So it is sometimes difficult to compare, but I don't think we're far off the mark from where the industry is.
Okay. Is this something that is being addressed? Is it related to, you're talking about the exhaustion, and obviously you're bringing in more drivers, but I also wonder about the mental health and the stress level that drivers are going through, because you'll have burnout for sure. How is that being addressed?
So in terms of absenteeism, going back to that chart, pre-2015, things were much better. Absenteeism did increase through all those detours and the frustrations. In terms of the mental health, I know that corporately, as you know, Mr. Kanellakis in his term of council priority, mental health was part of the strategy. There is a survey that is rolling out to every single employee that they fill that out. There's a questionnaire in that, and it speaks exactly to the area they're talking about, their overall wellness. We also have the peer support network at OC Transport, which has been nationally recognized as one of the best peer support networks. And then we have all those other channels that I've talked about in terms of wellness, and they can bring up issues and things like that. And then the section heads, which have dedicated groups of operators and mechanics, also look at absenteeism, and they work with employees to understand how they're doing, what's driving the absenteeism, how we can help them get back to work, how's their wellness, what's their personal issues that they need support with, and we've done phenomenal work in that area. With our HR teams, with the section heads, and with the union support.
Thank you. I appreciate that because probably in any organization, your biggest resource is human resource, and we want to keep them strong. So I really appreciate that you're doing that. In terms of the hiring that you're doing right now, how's it going on gender equity? Are you reaching out to encourage more women? to apply?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we work closely with our HR partners and make sure that we're hiring that diverse workforce that are representative of the city that we want to see. So that does factor into it, and we as I said, we work with our HR partners and make sure that we use all avenues to communicate out and get people aware and interested in applying.
Okay. Beyond the ones that we're hiring now, are we reaching out to encourage more women to apply in the future?
Yes, Mr. Chair, through our ongoing recruitment campaign, I mean, we're always sort of almost in that recruitment mode. So, yeah, we will continue to do those types of things, and we'll continue to engage HR and make sure that we're communicating in various different ways and to various different groups.
Thank you. In regards to the buses that were waiting different places, I see that they're going to be all over, not just at the baseball stadium. I appreciate that the idling is going to be reduced. I'm still puzzled why we need it, because fire trucks and ambulances don't sit there and idle, and they're emergency vehicles, but I hope that we will keep the idling almost till nil. I mean, we just passed the climate change emergency plan yesterday in terms of reducing greenhouse gases, so I hope that will be top of mind. Are you doing everything you can to mitigate this idling?
Councillor, that'll be your 5 minutes, too, if that's okay. So, Councillor Brockington, after you get your answer.
Yep.
Thank you.
That's fine. That's my
yes,
question.
Yes, we are. Yes, we are, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Councillor Brockington, followed by Councillor Leeper and Councillor Gower.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for
order,
calling.
Mr. Chair. Sorry, just in the, given the, that this is a Transit Commission meeting, is it not more appropriate for the order of speakers to be the transit commissioners first and then councillors off the transit commission after?
I think I can go to the clerk's office. I think we're allowed to do it either way, are we not? Who's over there?
Chair, that's your decision.
Yeah, so I'm doing it as the hands went up because we have a lot of councillors in the room. We're still, at this rate, we're still going to get through this by noon, I think. So if you don't mind, we'll run this way. Okay, sorry, Councillor Brockington, go ahead.
It's okay, fair question. First of all, thank you for calling this meeting. I want to get to the technical issues of the trains first. So the brain of the train, the TCMS system. And I've asked before if the four technical issues that we're working with now were identified during the testing phase. The answer was no. We've had trains on the tracks for over a year, so I'm trying to understand why the TCMS issue has only come up once we went for revenue generation service. What are the theories that you have why we're experiencing this issue now that passengers are on the trains and not for a whole year when we were testing the trains?
We don't have that answer, but we just hired a TCMS expert that will be funded through the chargeback to RTG to get to root cause and to answer all those questions. So there are theories. There's all those engineers meeting every single day from around the world. They've done the containment, so that's what's causing it not to go into the pause mode. But there is no root cause. But I'm not just waiting for the consortium. I'm bringing in a dedicated team that has done TCMS fixes around the world.
Okay. Appreciate the campaign for the doors. I listen to the radio every morning. I can't tell you the commercials I heard today. I have absolutely no recollection of any of the commercials I heard while listening to the radio. I think the most effective campaign for the doors are the stickers. If I'm about to pry open doors and there are stickers there, I'm not going to remember the poster I passed in the station. That might be all subliminal reminders, but I think it's the stickers on the doors, which I've seen in every other public transit system I've ridden on the doors. That is probably the most effective way. The drivers, I heard today for the first time that we're not going to have a full complement of 100 new drivers until June. That takes me by surprise. I thought we were going like gangbusters to make sure those 100 would be in place by the end of January, because we are going to have another bad winter. We're not going to have a full complement, and these cancellations are going to continue through the winter, which causes me great alarm. What is the challenge in hiring those folks all at once? Is it just a capacity issue on the training? Why can't we get the number of drivers we need hired and implemented as soon as possible?
So first and foremost, there's the MTO-approved requirement for the 36-day training. It spells out all the protocols as to what they have to do. And that's been audited by MTO. That's also been reviewed when we had the tragic accidents, and we have to follow that. What we did, we tried to do exactly what you were saying. How could we accelerate more hirings? And what we need are more trainers. So we looked to other properties, Toronto, Kingston, Cornwall, others. Could we second and we would pay and house their trainers? Unfortunately, everybody's trying to get operators across North America. There's a shortage. So we can't borrow from other properties. We're still trying. We're doing that. Contracted services, can we contract out and bring in professional trainers to have the bus types, the information that our in-house trainers have just simply doesn't exist. So what we've gone from is an increased schedule, longer hours, and right now what we're looking at is minimum 23 every 36 days. The team thinks they could do a little bit more, but we're continuing our strategy to see if we could second trainers from other properties, because that will help us do more.
So what are the timelines of, first of all, do we need just 100 drivers?
We're not stopping at 100. We're going to continue, because in that way we can build up the spare board so that the goal is get all the operators we need. The mitigating factor right now that we've just agreed with the union is we're going to reduce vacation allotments, and we pay them a premium for doing that for that period, which gives us those additional drivers that we need for the service in January.
Mr. Charter said that in 2019, particularly the second half of 2019, the two main reasons for route cancellations were detours and construction. I've always thought it was lack of drivers and scheduling issues. Am I wrong?
No, it was a compounding effect. The detours were a large component of it, but when we also started to experience the missed RSA dates, that became more and more problematic to recruit, and that did compound the issue. But detours, construction, as well as a challenge with recruiting operators was sort of the three things that were the primary causes.
So you have a plan to hire more drivers. What is the plan to actually have realistic schedules for our bus routes?
So, Mr. Chair, we and the most recent iteration of this is what's coming in January. We have a very good process to analyze operational data, the data that come from the buses of exactly how long they've taken to get over the route, to analyze that and make a recommendation for what the running time, what the scheduled running time on each route should be that hits the right balance between not having too short a time and not having too much time, because either one of those will cause disappointment to customers. The other part of it is to work on what is the right time that we should schedule at the terminal points between when the trip arrives and when the trip leaves, so that if a trip comes in a couple of minutes late, it can still leave on time, but not to spend more time than is necessary there, because that would take away resources that would otherwise be useful for more capacity for customers. So it's about hitting the balance on both of those. What's in the service changes that we emailed to you last week, and that'll be in this forthcoming memo, are the most recent round of that. They're the first one. It's the first round to be done using the actual operational data that we've been receiving since the major route change on October 4th. And this is a continuing process. There is funding from council for any additional changes we need to make, and we'll just continue to do this and make more changes.
So you have responded to a number of councillor issues that have been brought to your attention. That's reflected, at least partially reflected, in the January changes. But how are you analyzing the scheduling from sort of a macro level? We give you bits of information, but I want to be comforted that you're looking at the schedules from a citywide, a district level, to know that there are some scheduling challenges, problems that need to be fixed. So what assurances do I have that that is being done? Who's actually doing that type of analysis?
Mr. Acting Chair, the planning staff does all that, but as I said in my last slide, I think for you to gain that comfort, because you've asked me that before, That I point to the Auditor General, and his review of that will come back with if there are gaps, how do we close them, or if there's concerns or issues, and what are those gaps? Is it we don't have the right staff, we don't use the right methodology, we don't have the right funding source? I could sit here and try to convince you over and over again that, you know, we're doing it right, that we have some of the best planners in the industry, that we have some of the best software that runs the algorithm and so forth. But if that doesn't give you the comfort, because it's being asked over and over again, I suggest you talk to the Auditor General, because he can go in as deep and as hard as he wants to look at all this stuff, and I welcome it. I truly welcome it. That if there's improvements to do for the customers and for you as counsel, we will execute on that front.
Can you talk about your plans to bring an annual work plan to the Transit Commission, the particularly main objectives for the LRT, para, and bus service?
Absolutely, Councillor. I'm bringing a plan in Q1. We've always said once we got through LRT, we needed to go back to the rhythm of tabling an annual work plan for this committee. And that plan will list every single initiative that we're going to do other than business as normal. We will give you what the output of that is. You will review it. You'll tell us whether or not you want us to proceed on those. You can amend it. I know Councillor Flitty was talking about a motion. I suggested he brings that to that meeting on performance measurement. And then we report back, like other committees do, Hydro Ottawa, Parking Authority, and so forth, which I've done in my previous portfolios. So the following February, we'll come back to you and say, there's what you asked us to do, this is what we did, and we'll have metrics around that. So that's all coming in Q1.
Excellent. Just two more questions. One is, another contractor is lined up to take legal action against RTG, I think an elevator contractor now. Previously, I've asked about the risk to the city with the possibility that our maintenance contractor might go bankrupt because of their own financial challenges. Can you reassure us again that that threat is low, if not nil, and that despite some of their financial challenges with their contractors that they've hired to deliver, that the City of Ottawa and RTGM are solid for the next 30 years?
So there's multiple questions in there on the liens, which is what you're seeing out there. Our professional advice to you is stay totally out of that and do not concern yourself with that. You have thrown that all over to your contractor. That's between them and their subs. We have zero impact in there. As for can any of them go bankrupt or all of them go bankrupt, nobody will ever tell you never, but what you have backstopping you is the scope and scale of those organizations. You know, ACS Dragados, I think it's the third largest construction company in the world. But on top of all that, you have hundreds of millions of dollars of letter of credit and loan guarantees and tools at your disposal, not just pieces of paper, but actual funds that you can access in the event that they go sideways in any way. So you're backstopped very significantly in that eventuality. And there, it's not hundreds of thousands of dollars, it's tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in terms of all various options and scenarios you could do in the event that things start to go commercially wrong. And I understand that concern. I know there's tweets out there right now about SNC-Lavalin, so I totally understand where you're coming from.
Thank you. My last question for round one is just regarding station upgrades. Can I get, if I have to file an inquiry, I will, but I just would like to make a request. Since we opened on September 14th to now, part one, and what's planned after today, I'd like to know what station improvements or upgrades have occurred and are planning to happen at Tunney's Pasture, Herdman, and Blair. So I know you've probably sent out dribs and drabs, improvements, modifications that you've made. I just want to see a nice clean summary. Those three stations, what have we done already, and what are the plans? And I'll just remind you, I've asked for a quote for that wall to enclose Herdman Station on the north side. I asked this through the budget process. I don't know if a meeting's lined up. I'm not expecting to move that today, but in the lead up to 2021 budget, I want to see a quote at some point. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Councillor Brockington. Councillor Leeper.
Thanks, Chair. My question My first question is on behalf of Councillor Fleury, who asked me to look into the geographic disparity in terms of cancelled routes. Councillor Fleury obviously has been carefully tracking cancelled trips in his ward. He believes that there is a higher proportion of cancelled trips in his ward than elsewhere in the city. And he's wondering how the geographic disparity in cancellations can be mitigated. Are there ways in which you can make choices when determining which trips to cancel to reduce the impact on one geographic area versus another?
Mr. Chair, I make 2 points in response to that question. One is that we have heard this question from Councillor Fleury before. We're happy to look into it further, but our initial work so far shows that trips that are being missed or cancelled are roughly in proportion across the entire system to the amount of service that's provided in that area. So on the routes that we looked at that pass through downtown, the ones that pass through Councillor Fleury's ward, it's slightly less than 20% of all the service that we run, and it's slightly less than 20% of all the trips that are affected. However, there are two other aspects that can distort geographically where those effects would be felt by customers. One is that through the core of the city, the services are generally more frequent, and we will always try to protect those last trips and essential trips on a route, you know, at the extreme, a route that's going out to the rural area that only has 4 trips or 3 trips. We will want to make sure that all 3 of those trips actually run. If we're talking about a core service that runs every 5 or 6 minutes and there's a gap that runs, you know, a gap of 8 minutes because one trip's a gap that takes it to 8 minutes because one trip's been missed, that's something that can often happen more in the central area. The other is that routes that are running in the central area are, in the central area and on the highways, are the ones that are most susceptible to delay caused by external events. It'll usually be something that's causing severe traffic congestion, and that traffic congestion will slow down our buses and our customers. And that is, as John mentioned earlier, always more likely to happen on Bank Street or on Rideau Street than it is on Eagleson or Portobello.
What are congestion-related delays as a proportion, or cancellations as a proportion of all the cancellations? I think in the slide deck you listed probably 7 or 8 different categories or causes of cancellation. What proportion of those is congestion?
We have that information, and I don't have it here with me today. We can provide it in a follow-up if you'd like.
Okay. Yeah, and actually I think if you're prepared to put some quick work into following up on that, each of those categories, if you could give us a ballpark idea of which of those are the most common cause of cancellations, drivers versus congestion versus construction, et cetera. For my own part, I have a question. Pat, you had said, Mr. Manconi, I think you had said, if you're a junior operator, there's going to be a few years or a couple of years where you don't get the best route. We heard some drivers expressing concern that the lack of recovery time on their routes is cause for stress, it's cause for, and we've heard other councillors and commissioners talk about, you know, that can be the cause of medical issues. It's not good always being late and not having that recovery time. But we've said to our junior operators, you know, That's just part of it. How do I square that circle in terms of what's acceptable within the system? What I'm hearing you say is that it's okay to tell junior operators that for a few years there's going to be health impacts. It's acceptable to us that you're going to be running these kinds of schedules without the adequate recovery time that you need in order to have what most people would consider to be acceptable working conditions. Are we simply telling our junior operators, suck it up?
No, that's a great question. If I came across that way, that was not my intent. If I can, I just want to go back in time because it's all relevant to your question. It's a very important question. years ago when you started OC Transpo, you probably had to work 10 years before you got a weekend off. And that was, I'll be candid, the era of suck it up. That's what that you've got to earn that, and it's just the way it was back then. When I got appointed to this position after the strike, you know, things were challenging there in many fronts from a morale and a wellness perspective. And so we spoke to, because it ties into exactly what you're asking me, we didn't survey people, we spoke to almost 700 staff. And what they all came back with was, we love this organization, we love the city, and we will work very, very hard and well. We just need to be trusted and respected, and that was the theme that we worked together with them. From that, we said, from the operator's perspective, what are your top priorities? How can we make things better for your working environment? And recognizing the majority of people that operate for us, and they know it's not a bottomless pit. If you had all the money in the world, we could fix it all. But what they said was, please get rid of the three-piece work. And three-piece work is, you would come in three times throughout the day and run your runs. And for very small people, a group of people, that's okay. Majority of people, that's very disruptive to your life. You can't plan your daycare provisions. You can't plan your going home. You're working early. You're working midday. You're working late at night. There was over 100 of those runs. And by the way, very efficient. Very, very cheap to run. But horrible from a health, wellness, and morale. So we worked with the union. We worked with the city manager. We worked with the council. And we said, we're going to eliminate those. No advantage to the customer. There was a premium. You paid to eliminate that, and you invested in the organization. The second priority was more recovery time. And we were very clear with everyone. And that's why when employees come and talk to me on recovery time, they never leave the office hearing, I will fix your recovery time for you. It is a multi-year journey to address that recovery time because it's tens of millions of dollars without any direct benefit, there's indirect benefit, to the customer. And what we also did in the meantime was, by the way, if you're parked outside of Tim Hortons and you're going for a washroom break because you missed it, we've got your back. Because there was days, if you saw a bus in front of a Tim Hortons, it was, oh my goodness, look at what this employee's doing. We explained. I can remember, it was my first week on the job. That employee had to run in for a washroom break. So to your point, it is about that. Now, if you're at OC Transpo, you can generally get in your weekends off after a couple of years. So the working conditions have improved. Are they perfect? Absolutely not. It is a tough job on those busy routes in traffic. Those buses have a tough, tough role. And those operators have a lot of stress. We talk about that when we recruit them. We talk about their diets. We talk about, why did we invest in gyms? There was a big media report about OC Transpo has gyms. We want them in the gym working out. We do healthy eating clinics. So it's not suck it up, I can guarantee you.
Have we sought the opinion of occupational health and safety folks, health experts, to say this is how much recovery time is needed? Like, here's the working conditions that are tolerable, and do we have a target for reaching those tolerable working conditions?
No, we just know that on some runs it's not enough, and we need to do better, and hence the investment we've done with the budget allocation that we've got here, and we sprinkle it as much as we can throughout the system.
You've said that there is a financial cost to getting us to more recovery time. Is there a gap currently? I mean, you know, I voted against the Transit Commission budget because I saw a small operational increase in how much we're doing. Most of that presumably will go toward wages. Have we quantified the gap?
No, we have not, but it's a lot. And I got interviewed today. Adding a minute of recovery time across the system, if you just add, it's about $1 million.
But a minute is not enough, presumably.
No, so you would.
I know it's more nuanced than that, but.
No, so you would target, if you wanted to do a fix on recovery time, that's a number we can put together for you. But it's significant.
I think it's a number that we owe our employees to let them know that here's the gap between having healthy working conditions or not. I'll let transit commissioners determine whether or not they want to put that out there as a direction. Thank you for both answers. I appreciate it.
Okay, Okay, thank you, Councillor Leeper. Councillor Gower, followed by Councillor Wright-Gilbert and Councillor Kluge.
One thing in 2019 is I think we've all had our vocabulary expanded with new transit vocabulary. Dwell time, crush loads, and my favorite, I think, is strap hanger. And I wanted to ask, are we having like a worldwide strap hanger shortage? How come it's taking so long to get these strap hangers in?
I wish you were in the room when I asked that question. So it's a certain type of strap. There is a process to these things, and so they were able to secure the ones that we have now. They had an alternative one, but it wasn't the same length and so forth, so we said, no, we want the right ones, consistent. I don't want to have two types of straps on that. And just to answer the question as to how did we get here, we're paying, rough math, I think just under $200,000 right now to do it. We wanted strap hangers during the design of that train. And unfortunately, welcome to the world of P3s, we asked for a quote, and it was $1 million. And we said there's no way we could justify $1 million for strap hangers. So the plan was always to, you know, get into launch state, and then we would negotiate a price. So it was always the intent to have strap hangers in there, but there was a heavy, heavy premium that the builder, not the maintainer, wanted.
Where do they come from? That's kind of a trivial thing, but...
Mr. Morgan's up there. I'll get him to come down here, and he can
tell. All right, we can get it later. Actually, a little quick follow-up. There was a citizen campaign to suggest people use scarves or other items. Please comment on this advisability from a safety point of view of doing something like that.
So all kidding aside on this, I'm going to be very direct. Every single thing that goes onto a train goes through a safety case. And again, I, you know, point to bus accidents. When there is an accident, they take all that apart. So it's not because we don't want to just pick any strap. There's a safety protocol for that on those grab bars and so forth, and strength testing and everything else. So do not use anything to improvise as a strap hanger.
Okay. I will move on from strap hangers, but one last thought. For transit commissioners, there's an excellent book called Strap Hanger. Might be too late to get it on your Christmas list, but if you get a Chapters gift card, I would highly recommend it. Strap Hanger, written by a guy from Montreal. Okay, more serious things here. Late buses, canceled trips, especially canceled trips. There's a huge gap between public perception and data. The chart that we had up there would seem to clearly show that the bus system is far more reliable than it has ever been in the last few months or few years. The public perception is completely the opposite. So you must have given this some thought. What's going on here? Why is the perception so different from what that graph is showing us?
I'll go first, because I think everybody was expecting perfection, and many of you have commented to me that, you know, we would sit in this room and say, once we launch LRT, our bus system will become more reliable, and because they're not deadheading through the downtown core, interlined, and so forth. So to me, the way I look at it, I mean, this morning I think we had 40 cancellations. If you're that person that got their canceled bus, you don't care what that graph says. Your trip didn't come in. And, you know, but there was, I think we've had one or two days, there were zero cancellations in the morning. We didn't hear from anybody then. I think everybody's looking for perfection, and it's not good enough right now. I'm not defending it. But it will never be 100% in mixed traffic. And it will become much, much better. The system is still not stable, and we need to get it stable. And so there's a perception issue, but there's also a reality issue that in areas it's not performing well, and it has to perform better.
I would suggest one of the issues around the perception is, I think the graph was showing, was it showing canceled routes, or was it showing, I don't know if we can put it back up. It's cancellations. And one of the things that I consistently hear from residents, especially in the afternoon trips home from Tunney's, a bus like the 263, which runs every 30 minutes, there are times when that bus, one of the runs is running 15 or 20 minutes late. That's a could be a 45 to 50 minute wait for a 263 if that's the route you rely on. And as far as I can tell, there's no communications mechanism, no customer service mechanism to alert people about a delay that long, and it is significant. So have you thought about, is there, through the improvements in customer service, do you have plans to improve notification to riders when there are buses that are not necessarily canceled, but are they going to be more than 10 or 15 minutes delayed on a low-frequency route?
Mr. Chair, we have, we have new software which we have purchased and is being set up for our system that will give us better predictions of departure times from initial stations or initial stops on every on many bus routes. I won't say every because it's a very complex calculation to predict. All the information, the real-time information that we have been providing these last few years is about what time do we expect the bus to get to your stop, the stop you're asking about, based on two things. Where is the bus right now? And how long does it usually take to get from the point where the bus is right now to the point you're asking about? What is the schedule time from where the bus is now? So if the bus is normally doing this but is held up by 3 minutes before it gets to the first one, we will say expect it to come at 6:11 rather than 6:08 where you are right now. We, in our current system, we can't do that until the bus starts moving on the route. We have no ability to look at what that bus is doing before it starts the route. I know you all know, I'll just say as a reminder, we were the first transit agency to provide real-time information across the system. We were the first, certainly the first in Canada, the first of any size. The only ones that had tested it before, I recall Saskatoon and Guelph trying it out. We brought it in and published it for everybody, for the whole system, before it became a mainstream feature. The result of that, however, is that we're working now with the oldest home-built algorithms and software, and we are now replacing it with commercial software using all the latest math, all the latest thinking of how you can predict this information. So the new software that we're buying has the data analysis ability to look back at what that bus is supposed to do before it comes to that first stop. Is it coming off another route? Is it coming in from the garage? Is it sitting at that point waiting? And has the analytical strength to look back to where that bus is now and predict what it will likely do in the future. It won't be perfect. It'll be better. That software, as I say, is still in development. We will have initial parts of it ready to roll out during 2020, but that will be the initial parts. It's our main control system as well, and we have to work on the parts that are essential for running the service before we can move on to some of the added features that it, the doors that it opens for us. But that's a big part of the work that we're doing in our technology group right now.
So would another way to say that be it's software that can take into account the interlining of our OC transfer system? Is that what it's doing essentially?
It will be. Some of it is the interlines, but it has an ability to look back into what is the bus do, what is that bus doing before it's ready to start that trip, the trip that you're asking about.
Okay.
And that'll help lower frequency routes in the morning as they start from the outer end. In your example, you know, a 262, if you're just around the corner in Westridge and it hasn't started yet at Kittiwake, then you don't know. Once it started, you go, oh, the bus is coming 3 minutes late. Oh, if I'd only known it was 3 minutes, I would have done. But more important than that for us now with the new route system is being able to provide better information at Herdman, at Blair, at Tunney's, at Saint-Laurent for the buses that are meant to leave there at this time, this time, this time. If that bus is held up getting to that point and control center hasn't been able to take control action to slot another bus in to cover that trip, we'd like to be able to tell customers that trip's coming in 7 minutes rather than 4 minutes or whatever the time is.
Okay, that can't come soon enough. It's absolutely essential to addressing a serious customer service issue right now. So thank you. I have a quick question, then I'll quick wrap up. November 6th, this commission passed a motion about getting more regular reporting and issues tracking updates. And I know I've spoken with Mr. Manconi, but for the benefit of the rest of the commissioners, can you just give a quick update on when we should expect to start seeing that?
Mr. Chair, yes, we've drafted that, and we're looking forward to reviewing it with you, the Chair, and with Councillor Gower over the next few days so that we can start rolling that out soon.
Okay. And as a quick wrap, I was going to ask it as a question, but I think it's more of a statement. Just to staff, we need to know what support you need, whether that is around resources, whether that is around communications. I've already heard a few things here where, and I think other commissioners probably have too, where we go, if only we had known that, we could have approached this differently. And so it's a request to you. Just let us know what you need. We all want to improve our transit service, and we're all here to support OC Transpo in doing that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Councillor Gower. Commissioner Wright-Gilbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to the issue about the Parliament Station odor, and I thank you for providing us an update on that today. I'm still a little bit unclear. So if we cast our minds back to September 18th at this meeting, Commissioner Caricato actually brought up the issue of the odor at Parliament Station. And at that time, we were told that it was as a result of buildup of moisture in the escalator pit. A couple weeks later, on October 3rd, it was actually Mr. Charter who sent an email to News Talk 580 CFRA. He provided more information. It was a sump pump failure, but that the repairs had been made, the pits had been cleaned, and steps have been taken to eliminate the accumulation of moisture, and that's a direct quote. And that a sealant material was used to prevent Frutier leaks, and it's that sealant that is causing the smell while it continues to dry, and that's also a direct quote. It wasn't until the November 6th meeting of the Transit Commission that it was actually Mr. Morgan who informed this commission that the odor was actually caused by a puncture in a sewer line, which we now know is the case, in a couple of locations, by the rods that were used to keep things in place, and that RTG was tasked in November to repair the punctures. But we now know, as a result of Ms. Chianello's article for the CBC, that the city was aware of the puncture on August 9th. So what I think I want to do is to afford city staff the opportunity to explain how the connection was not made between there is an odor of sewage in Parliament Station since the line opened to it takes until November to make the connection between, oh, there's a puncture in a sewage line, we know this in August, but it's November until we actually make that connection. I want to afford staff the opportunity to clarify that.
No, thank you for that, and great question. I'm going to let Mr. Morgan walk through that.
So I think in November, Mr. Chair, we tried to, or I at least at the time, tried to identify that it was a working theory, that was contributing to the smell. So when we go back and look at the records for when the puncture actually occurred in the tunnel, the puncture occurred in 2015. That's when those rock bolts were installed at that location. That's where when they would have punctured the sewer. So, in reviewing that issue with RTG, you know, the nature and the design of those rock bolts shouldn't have contributed to a problem. The rock bolts are installed. They're 6 to 8 meters long. They're filled with an injection grouting to prevent water leaking through. The location is 100 meters away from the actual location of the smell in Parliament Station. So there was a number of kind of contributing elements that led us to believe that potentially it was a contributor. We absolutely know that the failure of the sump pump led to some buildup of liquid, and that liquid did not smell good and was contributing to a smell. And so correcting the sump pump, doing additional injection grouting to prevent additional liquid from getting into that area, drying it, obviously applying the deodorizer. It's questionable whether the deodorizer was helpful or a hindrance to the overall smell at that location. And then subsequently the repair to the sewer pipe, where they had to essentially go in with robotically and cut out the anchors, reline the sewer pipe, that was completed last week. All of those are contributing factors to this issue. it wasn't a single thing. If the sump pump hadn't failed, we may never have known of that issue at that location. We're still monitoring the issue. We still need to make sure that, you know, that it's resolved. You know, and so I'm, you know, wanting to make sure I don't want to declare success and then a week later find that there's still complaints about smell in that location.
Thank you. I appreciate the additional information, but my original question still stands, which is, how is it possible that the city knew about a puncture in a sewer line in August of 2019, and it was a working theory in November that was causing the smell of sewage in Parliament Station? Now, I can appreciate that the puncture happened in 2015 and that it was 100 meters away. However, that's 4 years of leaking sewage into the area. So, I mean, it doesn't take a genius to think that perhaps it traveled a bit. And so my question stands is that how did we not make the connection between, oh, we know there's a punctured sewer line and Parliament smells like sewage? I don't fully understand how we didn't make that connection.
So it was RTG who installed the rock bolts, and they had people working in that area for 4 years. And there was never a complaint about smell at that location. So, you know, we went back to RTG, and we asked them for clarification, for feedback, and they do not believe it's connected.
Okay, I don't believe that my question has yet to be answered, which is, so Mr. Manconi, I don't know if you want to jump in.
Certainly. I know, because I was in that station many, many, many times. There was no odor smell in Parliament in those periods, 2015 forward. And so the sewer department was running a camera down that line in August and noticed the rock bolts. But there was no connection made to any, so it's not like, oh, we knew about it and we didn't do anything about it. It was, no, by the way, there's some rock bolts in here, we'll look at it. And then in September, the line opens up and we start to get these complaints, and it smelled. I know I went down there the day of the opening, the day after the opening, and then everybody started focusing on what could be the issue. Was it the sump pump? Was it the sealant? Whatever. And as Mr. Morgan said, we're not even sure we've got this thing figured out. Was it the sewage? Nobody can tell us whether or not it was the sewage, the sump pump, or the other issues.
Okay, let me put it to you this way. Was OC Transpo, you, your staff, those folks, aware in August that there was the discovery of the sewage pipe being punctured, or was it the city? Because, I mean, obviously the city is a big organization. I work for the federal government. We don't always know what we're up to. So was OC Transpo aware of the sewage pipe being punctured in several locations on August 9th? Or was it some other, you said it was the sewer people, that's not right, but in the city?
We're all part of the city, so we're a department of the city.
I get that.
So the sewage crew saw that. And did someone in Mr. Morgan's large organization know about that? Perhaps, I don't know. I can tell you that the minute Mr. Morgan found out about it, he escalated to us and we escalated to you in terms of the issue.
So great, excellent. So that was in November then that Mr. Morgan knew about the sewage pipe puncture, because that's when we knew about it.
The theory about that being the possible connection to the smell got brought to my attention. We brought it in the update to you, and that's when we tabled it with you.
Okay. So I appreciate that you said that you're not entirely sure that the measures that we've taken have fixed the odor. I can tell you that I was there this morning. It's not smelling good, I'm not going to lie to you. So I can appreciate that it's something that we're still monitoring. So that's fine. I'll move off of the odor, because it's not a pleasant subject. I want to ask about the 14th train. You mentioned it earlier. You asked someone if they were asking about the 14th train. I was hoping, actually, it was Councillor Tierney. The 14th train that we've heard about for a couple of months, is that making an appearance soon? Is it?
You'll start to see the testing of it in the coming days, if not the next week or so.
Okay, excellent. You mentioned in your presentation that extra buses and operators are being strategically placed on standby at key locations to deal with bus cancellations. And my question is, how can we have extra buses and operators on standby in addition to the 20 that are for the R1 buses when there's so many cancellations and admittedly not enough operators for the regular schedule, would it not make more sense to have these drivers out on and fulfilling our actual published schedule?
Mr. Chair, we've had extra buses scheduled as standby buses across the system for, well, I was going to say forever, but let's say for decades. The number of those and the location of those we calibrate as the system expands. They are an essential part of reliable service, and every time we've talked repeatedly this morning about how the control center, the TOCC, is working very hard to fill every trip, to cover every trip. The majority of potential trips that could be canceled are always filled by an extra bus that's standing by somewhere out in the city, or someone agreeing to work a few minutes of overtime, or someone who's sitting in the garage being put on a bus and sent out to cover trip. The majority of problems, and I don't have the figure here today, are covered and are invisible to customers, except that they might see a different operator than they would normally, or except that they see a different vehicle type than they would normally, a larger or smaller bus. That's an essential part of what we do. We would never recommend reducing the number of standby buses to provide more service, because that would reduce service quality across the entire system.
Okay, thank you. I only have two more questions, Mr. Chair, and then I'll allow my colleagues. What percentage of cancellations are actually posted publicly? There's been some speculation that, and you alluded to it a bit this morning, about that, you know, if a cancellation is on a high-frequency route, then we're not going to necessarily publish it online because it would cause more confusion. I'll leave that. But what percentage of cancellations are actually posted publicly online?
Mr. Chair, I don't have that number here today.
So if you could follow up with this commission, that would be great, just to let us know what the percentage is, because there's quite a few opinions about what is actually being posted publicly online versus what is in actuality happening. And if we had that number, then perhaps we could, and it's a favorable number, then we could combat some of the public information that's out there, and that could definitely help OC Transpo. My last question is actually about something that was mentioned during the meeting about 20 minutes ago. Mr. Manconi stated that we've, quote, agreed with the union that we will decrease vacation allotments and pay out for vacation. Is this mandatory for all drivers, or is it voluntary?
No, it's voluntary. It's part of our mitigation measures. We did that leading up to the launch, and we need to do that for January to do exactly what you're asking us to do, get as close to a good, reliable service as we can as we ramp up with operators. So okay. It's a one-time, it's documented, it's reviewed by labor relations, it doesn't get enshrined in their collective agreement, both parties have to agree to it, and there is a premium to it, and we track all the costs, and it goes into the RTG chargebacks.
Thank you. I can put you back on the list if you want. You're about 20 seconds over now, so
20 seconds.
Is that okay?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
All righty. Councillor Cloutier, followed by Councillor McKenney, and followed by Councillor Meehan.
Merci beaucoup, Monsieur le Président. Thank you, Mr. Scrimger, Mr. Charter, Mr. Manconi, for your presentation. And we're glad to see that the LRT has been getting better. I just had a couple of questions about that, and thank you to Commissioner Wright-Gilbert for asking about the 14th train and the importance of that higher frequency and that the additional redundancy that it will bring. Can you talk to me about the other trains that are being tested? Some trains are from phase two, but they have been built, and I understand that they're going to be tested at some point in 2020.
Yes, and just to clarify, there's no timeline yet for the launch of the 14th or 15th train. As you know, we have all those trains from the stage one, but the risk on the TCMS, the VOBC, so we put the best trains, most reliable ones out there, and have the other ones on standby. So you'll see testing of two extra double sets starting in the coming days, weeks. No timeline on when I can launch the 14th and the 15th train yet, because I want a very, very high reliability. I do not want to inject a vehicle that could get into TCMS failure or VOBC. The schedule is ready to be written. The minute we launch that 14th train, that provides us an additional capacity and relieves the some of the overcrowding and things like that that I know people have been expressing. And as soon as we get that timeline, I'll be sharing it with the Commission.
Thank you for that. The TCMS, you talked about getting a new software that came out on December 7th, but the root cause, and you're still, my understanding is you're still unsure about the stability. You referred to the root cause. Can you tell me, the system seems to be operating well now, the instances of TCMS failures are down. What additional improvements are we looking for on that system?
So the TCMS issue is not solved. It's contained, and that was done using adjustments of literally milliseconds in the MPUs, the processors, so that it doesn't go into that fault mode. Before, we were doing resets, and that's like a circuit breaker in your house. You don't want to be resetting it all the time. There are between 6 to 10 working theories as to what the root cause is. And that's why we were very fortunate, we found an expert that has done TCMS problem solving and rectification. His work starts in mid-January with us. He's from overseas, so we have to do some paperwork to get him over here. But that team is going to be working for us. They're going to be injected into the working group with RTG and get full access to data logs and so forth to look at root cause. But it could be everything from wiring to computer sensitivity to code issues. It's very, very complicated data to analyze. But once you can zoom in on the root cause, then you can fix it.
Is that fix at the expense of RTG?
100% on their dime.
Okay, thank you. Slide 12 showed the instances of switches that are trending in the right direction. But I note on slide 12 that the highest instance of track switch issues was the week of ending November 17th, which we had a big snowstorm on November 11th and 12th. We haven't had such a snowstorm since then. What's our confidence level in the switches and in the adjustments that RTG might have made? I think you referred to in the past some covers that were removed or they didn't have the right covers. Can you just update us on that?
Yes, so the winter covers have been removed. We're not going to tolerate those anymore. In addition, we ask that in morning and afternoon rush hour, they have dedicated switch technicians at Blair and Tunney's. That's where those crossovers are. That's where if those switch goes into disturbed, there's a problem. The one instant when we had a situation there was because the technician wasn't there on time. But now they're there during the morning and afternoon rush hour. And then on snow and ice predicted days, they have staff there to augment the electric heaters that keep those switches moving and free of ice and snow. But if for some reason they go into default, then they can get in there and sweep it out, blow them out, and things like that. So we're just layering on extra layers of protection, and that's RTEM's requirement.
Is that in our winter operations of the LRT system, is that the biggest element of risk or of potential failure? Is it switches or is it another system in the train?
I'll let Mr. Morgan walk you through risks. There's multiple depending on the type of winter.
So I think the switches, keeping the switch heaters moving, that's kind of a critical point. I think the advantage that we have on our system using the overhead catenary as opposed to the third rail, many systems that operate with a third rail, a power rail low to the ground, are susceptible to winter issues. They quickly get affected by very little snow. Obviously, the overhead catenary is susceptible to freezing rain in some conditions. We have some mitigations for that. But that certainly, I think, is a better solution than going with a third rail for our winter conditions. And then broadly, I would say less a system issue, but more of a vehicle issue. As snow, depending on the weather conditions, as snow tends to build up and cake onto brakes and the undercarriage of the vehicle, or even kind of if you get a drifting snow into the rooftop components, occasionally you will see some reliability issues with those trains. We have the fortunate setup in the yard where our trains are largely covered on the overnight period, and so while we will likely run some vehicles during the nighttime to help keep the tracks clear, the rest of the fleet is essentially indoors, which helps, you know, prevent any buildup overnight and make sure that they're ready for launch in the morning. So that's kind of a flavor of the, say, three or four things that are of concern in winter operations.
Okay, thank you. The R1 service, any update on till when it will be the replacement standby R1 service, which on slide 21 you indicate will be redeployed from RTG Stadium to other staging points. Any update on till when we'll see that? And again, the discussions with RTG with respect to when the train is going to operate at a contractually acceptable level and their predisposition to paying for that service.
Councillor, that's exactly the spot that we're looking for, is if the trend continues of very, very, you know, high 98-99% availability with no major interruptions, we can then turn our head to, do we reduce the 20? Do we step it down to 15 to 10? And then again, that helps us because then we have buses and we have operators that we can deploy on regular bus service. We're not there yet. I need to see more consistent weeks like last week. And then the other thing is we do want to see a few winter events go through, both freezing rain and snow, to see how that train system performs and make sure that, you know, I'll give RTG credit. They've doubled up a lot of equipment. They've taken our advice to have it located in strategic locations and so forth. So we need to see that in action. We've only had light snowfalls right now in terms of that. So just being cautious.
With respect to information for our customers, and I'm happy that we're going to see the public service campaign with respect to holding the doors, have you considered any public service campaign or signs with respect to cooperative seating and courtesy seating? I've seen on the trains some persons standing and when they should have a seat.
Yes, we have campaigns out on those. We have two of our seven themes that are out at launch. Are on that subject. Those posters are up in all stations and on all trains, and we've had little short animated videos appearing across the internet on YouTube and Facebook and places like that. We have always been ready to respond with the number of impressions we put out for each of these seven campaigns, depending on what we found to be most important. It was identified quite early on that doors were the most important thing that we needed people to understand, so we ramped up in the ways we talked about earlier, information on those points. We're also looking to expand that to more than seven topics. Seven was the ones that we thought we could bombard people with at the beginning of train operation. We'll be adding to that more topics, more advice to customers on what to do and not to do to be courteous to their fellow customers, and we will continue to adapt that as time goes on, depending on what issues we need to resolve. But that's already, you know, that was more of an issue that we were communicating initially than doors. It's just that we ramped up doors, and we've been talking about doors more since October.
Okay. With respect to door operations and educating our customers with respect to informing our customers with respect to door operations, the plan was originally to have the door, the configuration of the doors to change during the winter months so that it might be a push-button operation. Is that still the plan, and what would be the information campaign with respect to that?
We would love to change to that, but we don't want to do that until I have clear line of sight on the doors in terms of where they're going with their fixes. They have to recalibrate them. So forth. We are being very cautious right now. The system's running well. I don't want to introduce change that causes it to get into delay mode for our customers. So we're getting a full assessment on the doors. There's lots of engineers and door specialists looking at what we have to do and the timelines for that.
Okay. I saw some media, or could have been on Twitter over the weekend, with respect to a frozen surface at Blair Station that was blocked off, a section that was blocked off to a frozen surface. Is there, the platforms are heated. Was that a one-off occurrence, or have we found that the heated platforms to be effective in that type of weather situation?
Yes, Mr. Chair. You know, the majority of the outdoor station platforms are heated, but there are sections such as the inner concourse area or the inner part of the platform that is not heated. That is something that RTM and RTG recognize that they need to focus on, you know, doing some pre-soaking or pre-salting when there is an event that's coming. So the heaters are effective, but they're mostly at the loading sections for people who are loading on and off the train. But some of the other areas aren't necessarily heat traced, so they need to make sure that they're doing a better job of pre-soaking, as I said, or putting salt down in advance of that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Councillor Cloutier. Councillor McKinney, followed by Meehan, followed by Commissioner Olson, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Listen, I want to talk about the reliability of our bus system. It is, you know, again, I go back to almost every message I get, certainly what we see in the media, what we see social media. The operator that came forward last week pretty well said what most people who talk to me anyway are thinking. So I don't want to walk away from here today with the message that everything is fine and it's as planned, because then I don't really have any confidence that anything's going to change, and things need to change. So I just want to back up a little bit and talk about what happened as we were going into our expected revenue service. So we had how many buses were eliminated out of how many, and how many operators were given pink slips, and I get that, not pink slips, but had the, you know, how many operators did we eliminate from our full roster, and what was that percentage?
Sorry, the first part was what, Councillor?
Buses, the yeah. number of buses, and then the number of operators. Yeah. So what were the decreases?
The number of buses, approximately 180. The operators, the estimate when we first started this way back was around just over 600 was the number. Nobody got let go.
Mm-hmm.
We managed vacancies, retirements, because we, you know, a workforce of 1,500, you can imagine every single year you've got high attrition numbers. So we managed vacancies, retirees, and we offered premiums for people to do extra work in lieu of hiring and then firing or laying off within weeks or months. And it got tougher and tougher with those four delays that I think some people are forgetting, that, you know, oh, we're just around the corner. Remember, RTG stood in this room and said, we've got March, we'll get you March. And that changes again and changes again and so forth. So, and by the way, on your opening comment, if we're leaving you the impression that everything's perfect, that is not my message to you today.
Far from perfect.
No, that's not my message either. Okay. My message is rail is performing well lately.
Yep.
Bus, we hear the customers loud and clear. We hear the operators loud and clear. We got a lot of work to do on bus service.
Okay, I appreciate that. So the reduction in the number of buses and the reduction in the number of operators, understanding that it happened through attrition, that's not my point. We're now reversing that. Why? What was the rationale for taking that service when we launched light rail, or as we were going to launch light rail? It was only replacing what was already there. It was replacing bus rapid transit. It was replacing the people who are already moving along that line. I'm not sure, and I'm not a transit planner, but I'm not sure what rationale was used to say, now we need less bus service, when in fact we were only, and that wasn't your decision to move it along. It was, you know, that was a decision made a few years ago, a wrong decision, but, you know, in my opinion. But what rationale then was used to say, well, now we need less buses, because we really weren't adding capacity to the entire network. We were just replacing what was there.
So 9 years ago, when this project came together, there was very good thought process of, if you move to light rail, you can move more people more efficiently, lower costs, with fewer buses and fewer operators. There's no doubt about that. That's simple math to calculate that. Whether we all want to accept it or be comfortable with it, there was also a financial reduction that had to come out of OC Transpo's bottom line. I inherited all those numbers. This team inherited all those numbers.
Did.
And
that's my point.
And it was, you know, depending who you asked, it was somewhere between $10 and $14 million for fewer buses and fewer operators. And you go back to all my presentations when I inherited the file about not just run OC Transfer, but build it, and I brought you updates on this is our estimate on that. Now, there is definitely a reduction in the bus fleet and the operators and the mechanics to run that service. In stage one, that's your biggest reduction. Stage two, it's less because you're getting further out on that. Was the estimate perfect? Obviously not. Mr. Scrimger took both the financial target and the math associated with reducing that. Now, I can tell you, this team adjusted those earlier estimates. They were much, much higher. And that all ties into your financial affordability plan. It's built on LRT will save you money, become more efficient, and then you can afford things down the road. And I'm not saying it was a flawed process. Was it perfect? No, and things changed. Your economy changed, your ridership changed, and so forth. So that was the best available information for Mr. Scrimger and his team to shrink the operation to match them. And we didn't take it as deep as originally estimated. We actually made it. I know I sat in Mr. Kirkpatrick's office with Marion Similac and said those targets, those objectives that were set, were way too high. And we brought them back. I can tell you, you know, I hear about what's your ridership bump estimates. There was people estimating 9-10% ridership increases. And those were brought down too. What's your budget forecast for ridership? It's not 10%. We brought them more conservatively. You know, Councillor Hyatt work. Be conservative. If you exceed that, that's a bonus to all of us. So how far are we off is the question. Is it the 40 buses? I don't know. But it was always planned to do an adjustment, and in the 2020 budget, there was a bookmark where Marion and myself and others said we should invest further in reliability and in the growth areas. You've all talked about those gaps. So how far are we off? Don't know, but that was always the game plan to adjust. We never anticipated it would be perfect, and like I said, we're not at perfect.
But I will repeat my point. And my point is that council of the day and subsequent councils, based on flawed logic, replaced a system that was already there. There is no new capacity. They replaced a system that was already there that ran on the outskirts of the city and reduced, forced you to, whatever, however we want to nuance that, but reduce the budget for overall transit. And that's where we are today. I do want to finish. We have much worse service than we did 9-10 years ago. We do. I take transit. I can see it. I don't like getting on those trains during rush hour. They are so crowded. I used to be able to take a bus. Now I can't. Buses don't show up. I want to talk about that too. Canceled trips. You cannot tell me that I can pick up a schedule today, one of those paper schedules, and base my day on it and get around. I can't. There is nothing. The schedules, I don't know what they're based on. They're not. And if you are using an app, and if you look at when is the next ride coming, unless you're using one that's got on-time GPS, it tells you when the next one's coming, but then it just disappears if it doesn't come. Like, there's nothing in the system that is dependable. There is nothing in the system today that gives people confidence as they're moving around. And let's talk about weekends, when actually people who are, you know, lower income have to get around on the bus. They're not just coming in to work, you know, from other parts of the city, but they're lower income. They've got to do their groceries, get their kids around. And weekends is when we have the most unreliable service. So here we are today. I'm not laying blame at your feet here. I am saying, quite frankly, that decisions that have been made about the LRT, about the outcomes, and about transit have led us to a place today where we do not have adequate bus service for a city of 1 million people. So I'm going to leave that there. I want to
thank you, Councillor.
Yeah, thank
that's
you.
Your time, if that's where you want to stop. Do you want to go back on the list?
I'll definitely go back on the list. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Councillor Meehan.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Manconi, earlier today you said you thought there were 40 trip cancellations. Is that correct?
I just doubled it. It was 40 for operators. It's 63 total is what that was a couple hours ago.
Okay. My information says that we were 52 canceled trips as of 8 a.m. this morning, and a shortage of 70 drivers. So the reason for most of those cancellations was that we just didn't have the operators. This is getting to be pretty regular, and it's pretty scary. And I'm just wondering, do you have a plan? I mean, aside from, I know that we're going to hire 23 more drivers, and we're going to have a complement of 100 by June, but what is the plan to mitigate this? Because I don't have the confidence that we're going to get out from underneath this. We're going to have this level of cancellations and maybe even more over the wintertime.
I've shared with the commission the plan.
Sorry, I was sitting over the side. We don't often get the audio. Can you just give me the plan is to hire more drivers?
We are hiring more drivers. We are working with the operators to see as much overtime as we can. We're in a rough period of time right now with December. I've said that the team is exhausted. We are having some rough days. We're having some good days. Weekends are particularly challenging because, you know, we can't even ask those people that are on the 20 dedicated buses to come in on the weekend. That's how we suddenly tanked on the weekends. We had those operators that were on the R1, they were booking the overtime to cover the weekend piece. So, for December, we're in a bit of a rough spot right now. The hiring started before budget was even approved in terms of the preliminary assessments, and we have a full class that's starting on December 23rd.
Okay. The 20 new buses and the operators that we brought online, are they, in fact, all receiving overtime at this point?
You're talking about the 20 dedicated R1 ones?
No, the 20 new buses that we added, I guess, was it, when was that? No, we've the buses that we that the mayor announced earlier was, yes, 40. I'm just there's 20 new buses. I'm told that where the operators are all getting overtime in order to man those buses.
They are. They're though. It's the 21 R1 standby buses. They're all on premium time. Yes.
Okay. And is it in fact true that sometimes there are garage staff that are sitting at those bus at the wheels of some of those buses because we don't have drivers? Is that could that be in fact a happening?
No, not that I'm aware of. I don't believe so. No, we staff those. Those are priority routes for our operators to be on, and you know, that's something I can look into further. But no, I would be very surprised if that is the case.
Okay. Besides the vacation pay buyback that is going to start happening in January, if that doesn't, in fact, result in more drivers. Coming into work. Will OC Transpo be looking at mitigation pay again in order to entice the drivers to work?
Yes.
And is that going to be triple time as it was in the past?
There was multiple mitigation measures. And we're just, again, being cautious in terms of the vacation piece is one thing we've done. Mm-hmm. We're also looking at the spare board. We're doing when do those new hires come in, plugging those in, because that January schedule covers you for the first quarter of the year. So we're going to be onboarding a bunch of new operators as soon as they're ready. They literally start the next day. They have a graduation. They sign up at the union hall, and then they're on a bus, in some cases, that same day. Okay. So we're doing every sort of mitigation we can.
And is this all figured into the budget? Because it seems that there's so many moving parts to this. Like, it's be really hard to hammer down a bottom dollar. Like, how much is this going to cost us?
It is a very complicated operation. Yeah. There's lots of moving parts. It's one of the busiest transit bus systems in North America, and with the most complicated booking system in North America, with the most unique booking rights in North America, and in terms of the costs, the premiums, such as the mitigation measures for the vacation, is all being tracked, and that's all going to RTG.
That's still sort of up in the air, too, though. That's a concern for a lot of people.
I understand your concerns. We gave you the update at FEDCO. We're using all the provisions. I'm depending on expert P3 lawyers' opinions. I'm not a lawyer. Okay. I've had lawyers brief the city manager, the chair, the mayor, saying you're entitled to recover all these costs. That's the best I can tell you.
Okay. Thank you for that, Mr. Manconi. Talking about training the drivers, you said there's a shortage of trainers, and this is a problem that's every city seems to be going through, but isn't it fact that we use our own operators to train? So if we were going to train more people, we'd have to take some operators out of their buses. Isn't that the way it works?
Councillor, obviously, yep. People are sharing information with you. They're called reliefs. Mm-hmm. And so in the perfect world, we'd call up every single relief we have, and those reliefs right now are not happy with us because we've only called up 3 reliefs. The rest of them, they're out driving. They would love to come in and do training. We need them driving buses. So we've optimized the goals, and we've brought up 3 reliefs. Originally, we wanted to bring up 12, and it's a premium for them. They can come over. They're staying in operations. And yeah, those are difficult decisions that this management team makes, mm-hmm. And so that's to align perfectly with your goal of putting out service.
So it's a sort of a chicken and egg thing. We need more drivers, but we need the people who would train our driving. Okay, understood. One last question. I'm concerned now about Stage 2 LRT, Trillium Line, and I met with Mr. Morgan last week, and I was trying to get assurances that the issues that we've identified in the Stage 1 stations, like coverage, defense from the wind, station platforms, materials, and that sort of thing, we would not be repeating many of the lessons that we learned in Stage 1. And correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Morgan, but you said the designs are pretty well set. It's hard to figure out if, in fact, we're going to be tweaking those designs so that we don't have the same problems. I just need a guarantee that we're not going to have stations that are going to cause us problems when we open the Stage 2 LRT. And we don't want to go in and retrofit afterwards. We'd like the work to be done now when it's more cost-effective.
Mr. Chair, we're clearly taking all the lessons from stage one in terms of the slippery surfaces, in terms of the coverage, in terms of the strap hangers, to make sure all of those things are incorporated into the Stage 2 stations, mm-hmm. trying to make sure that we still go back to the community and get any additional feedback on those stations. I think that the message that I've been trying to provide at FEDCO, was that the opportunity to change to fully enclosed stations, to an entirely different architecture, that opportunity has passed. But there still is opportunity to look at, bus loop configuration and coverage at bus loops and the application of, shelters and how that's done, and looking at, for example, some of the crowding issues to make sure that the crowding in Stage 2, where ridership levels are going to be lower at some of those end stations because we've now dispersed a lot of the riding passengers, to make sure that we still account for whatever kind of crowding activity will occur at those transfer stations.
So explain to me what that opportunity is going to look like, because we really want to be putting input into this so that it's right. We don't have the complaints when they're open. Where's our opportunity going to happen?
Mr. Chair, I've been meeting with counselors. I met with Councillor Meehan.
Yes, you
That's an opportunity. I met with the East End counselors yesterday morning. You know, I'm absolutely, you know, my door is open to all the counselors to start those discussions. We've been out in the community doing consultations, bringing designs out to the community. So, you know, we're open. We're taking in all the feedback. We're available to meet at any time.
And that's going to be, like, I mean, I've seen the renderings of what the stations are going to look like, but the detailed, what the materials are going to be like, where that kind of thing, we're going to have input into that?
Yeah. Councillor, if I could, I'm trying to be helpful when I say what I'm about to say. This is a P3. You're locked, and you're going ahead. And I'm hearing it from councillors. They want to change things. They want to build elevators, escalators, bridges, all that stuff. And extra glazing, and so even Councillor Brockington's request, I'm going to bring that back, that estimate to you, and you're going to have to move a motion and find a funding source. You are 99.9% locked in. That's how P3s work. There's fine-tuning you can do. I'm on your page, Councillor. Trust me. I don't want you to think that you're going to be able to go in and start doing significant designs right down to quality finishes and colors and textures and things like that. It's simply not the way it works.
Well, I think then maybe we should
Councillor Meehan, can I just interject something here for you? Yeah. You got 30 seconds left. The stage two questions, the design, all that, that's all for FEDCO. We're dealing with the transit update of the operations today.
Yeah.
So if it's okay, if you can hold those for FEDCO.
Sorry, I know there were other questions, so I'm sorry. Just one last question. Is OC Transpo Management, are you eligible for bonuses this year?
Councillor, I'm not going to get into our private labor relations matters.
That's a fair question.
You could ask the city manager that, Councillor.
Yep. Those questions go to the city manager. You're not supposed to be asking managers what their pays are or bonuses or anything.
I'm not asking how much. Yeah. I'm just wondering if there's a bonus that's they're eligible for bonuses.
Direct it to the city manager. I'm sure you'll get an answer.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, Commissioner Olson, followed by Councillor Dudas, followed by Councillor Blay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McConey, for the January service changes, what is the source of funds for them? Is it all new money?
There was $7.5 million approved in the new budget of new funding for service, and we are using, I don't know, maybe third to a half of that. I don't have a full tally on the service changes that are announced already for January.
Okay, thank you. With respect to the cancellations, and I know this has been a big topic, and I heard Councillor McKenney say that service was better, you know, 10 years ago, and I don't live downtown. I didn't 10 years ago, so my memory is a little bit different. I just wonder, from your perspective, what do the actual data say? There were cancellations, obviously, before now. There were cancellations 10 years ago. Are we getting better? Are we getting worse?
Mr. Chair, there was a long time that cancellations were very stable at around, that service delivery was very stable at around 98.5%. So, in other words, cancellations at 1.5%. There was a discussion longer ago than I can remember when it was, but certainly after I started here, long before I was in this job and my colleagues in their jobs, there was a discussion about what would it take to increase that number. How much money would you have to put into the budget to bring 98.5 up to 99 or 99 point something? And there was also a very serious discussion about how much savings could be extracted from the budget by reducing that down to 97%. In the end, neither of those was made as a policy decision of council. So we went along at 98.5%, and you can see it in the beginning of the chart that Troy showed earlier, and we stayed in that range until we got into the detours and until we got into the missed delivery of the line and all of the things that created, and that's what pushed it up to the 5% cancellations that you saw in that chart, the peak. And then you see it drop back down to where we are right now, about 98.5%. What we need to do now, what we hope we will do now, is get the stability so that we're not bouncing up and down different week to week, except during those weeks where there's external events that we can't avoid, and that we're not bouncing up and down between weekends and weekdays, when we can get to the consistent rate that the service runs at this level, that our standby buses and other measures that we use, the spare board, are enough to fill most of the gaps that occur, then we'll be back into stability. Council hasn't changed their direction to us, so we need to get back to a point of stability where people can count on the bus and the train coming almost all the time, but can expect that sometimes, rare occasions, something happens to interrupt their trip.
Okay. How long have you been tweeting the cancellations of at least some of the routes?
I'm not sure. I can check. It's a few years ago, we just started publishing the same alerts that we were already sending to people who subscribed. After Twitter came along, we said, well, let's publish them over there too, make them more accessible to people. I can find out. It's been a few years.
It's not a huge deal. But before Twitter, was there any opportunity to communicate in real time, canceled routes?
Yes, exactly the same way we still do now. The manual notifications still go out to the people who subscribe to either email or text notifications by route, and they're all posted on the web. So those have been there since the beginning of when we started doing that. Later on, we added those two Twitter channels as a way of aggregating all of them.
Okay. I've heard reports of panhandlers in some of the trains going around asking for handouts. And I don't know the legality of it, but is this something that OC Transpo is aware of? Is there anything that OC Transpo or the city can do? I've never heard or seen one on a bus, and don't know if this is condoned on the trains or if it's something that should be looked at or not.
Yes, it is prohibited. Panhandling is prohibited on our system, whether it be on bus or on trains. We do have a team of special constables that are always riding the trains. They're always on the system. So when we become aware of those situations, we dispatch them to deal with it. We do have an approved process for buskers, but no, panhandling is not something that is permitted, and we would send staff to deal with that.
Okay, and my final point, I know that my colleague, Commissioner Wright Gilbert, dwelt on this a fair bit. Parliament Station, I actually don't know if maybe this is a gender equity thing, because I was there this morning. I actually lingered after the train to let the rush go. I smelt nothing. So, I don't know if this is something. It is a scientific fact that women have more developed senses of smell than men do. So I don't know if this is part of it. So I'm not saying that she didn't, that she smelt something that wasn't there. But I smelt nothing, so I'm not sure what the issue is, or in fact there is an issue.
I take offense to that, Commissioner. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I take offense to Commissioner Olson's comments about me smelling things because I'm a female. I'm going to ask for an apology now, please.
No, I will not give it.
Seriously?
Okay, Councillor Dudas. Your comments are noted. Thank you. And we'll speak up. Okay.
I'd like to speak about it too.
Councillor Dudas, go ahead.
Okay, wow. Okay. I have to follow that. Cancellations. I would like to know what is the number. I mean, zero is never going to happen. I mean, life happens, things happen. But what is the magic number that OC Transpo strives to achieve on weekdays, on weekends, that would have the very least impact on customers, so almost to the point where they wouldn't even notice it?
Obviously, the goal is zero. That's seldom attainable. We did, prior to 2015, have the odd day where we had zero cancellations. The numbers that Pat was talking about is 98, that 98.5, 98 range. What I will say also is part of the work we're bringing forward to you on the performance monitoring, which all of you, Councillor Gower, others have talked about, we're looking forward to that because I think that's the time you can have this policy discussion about what number do you want us to strive for, and then we can have a budget discussion about what would it take to get to whatever number we want to get to. But we're right now it's we're trying to get back to those 2015 levels, which was around that 98% of service delivered out of those 8,600 trips in a day, excluding snow days, protest days. I think we had a protest a couple weeks ago. You know, we went sideways bus-wise because we couldn't get through the core and so forth. So it's on good average typical days. What are we striving for?
What is the industry standard for that optimal magic number?
So I'll introduce it, then Pat will turn over. We just joined an international benching marking group. We had to apply to get into that. We will start to see that data. Pat, did you want to comment on that?
There's not much I can say. We're starting to look at the data for rail systems. We are still working with the similar organizations that do bus benchmarking and bus measurements. We've not yet been accepted into that group, and as a result, we don't yet have access to their data. We are working with our contacts at the convener of the organization, but the convener of the group, but it's really the group governance that decides who joins. And so we don't have full access to bus benchmarking across the world yet. What we do have access to is detailed bus benchmarking across all of Canada and at another level down across Canada and the U.S.
Okay.
However, I don't have the number that would answer your question.
So with OC Transpo and with the City of Ottawa, you know, we always want to be leaders in all things we do. So I look forward to having that discussion about performance measurements and setting a target. Are you confident that all the actions that you're taking in the plan that you've set forward, including hiring new bus operators and trainers and those things, do you think that it's going to get you to that standard of not necessarily the zero cancellations, but that optimal number that you're trying to achieve?
It'll get us in that direction. I don't know exactly where we'll go, but we want to get better, and that's our goal.
I understand you spoke to Councillor Meehan's question about budgets, and I get that we're putting the cost back to RTG, and I fully endorse that. However, there'll come a point where we're looking at the costs for the additional bus drivers, the additional trainers, the additional buses, that just becomes operational. What can we anticipate to see in the 2021 budget in terms of additional pressures?
So there'll be a capital pressure at some point for those 40 additional buses when they have to get replaced, so we'll put that into the capital long-range financial plan. The other piece will be how much further investments you want to do across reliability, expansion of the service, and so forth. And then anything that we learned from the $7.5 million investment, whether it was good enough, not enough, and the quarterly changes, we check in with you, and we just keep that tab running, and then we'll bring that forward in the 2020. So it's the 40 buses. The 20 I put aside because for the R1 because that's all being charged back to RTG. And so it's really what happens with the 7.5. Is that good enough? Does it answer the question you just asked me? Are we going directionally to that higher standard of service and achieving fewer cancellations?
Because transit is enormously subsidized by our taxpayer base, you know, which of course us as council approved, and we want to invest in our transit, and we can't continue to raise fares if we're not improving the quality of service. So I think that, you know, it would be very helpful to understand potentially prior to the 2021 budget just exactly what those pressures look like, because we can't keep going back to our tax base to compensate for reliability. We can't keep raising fares. So there's that chicken and the egg syndrome. I also want to understand, so the how many operators do we currently have off on leaves, long-term leaves, sick leaves, and what kind of pressure does that put on, or if any, in terms to your human resources?
Mr. Chair, that would be a number that I'd have to pull for you, but it does vary depending on time of year and season. But you know, for all types of leave, you know, like long-term disability, parental leave, those types of things, you know, the number of inactive operators could be around that 50 to 60 range, recognizing that we are a workforce of about 1,500. But then you'd have to layer on that the day-to-day absences or issues that they may populate as well.
Because I know Mr. Manconi mentioned they're exhausted. I've talked to so many of them. We all know they've been completely worn out. You're looking at them potentially providing some of the, we're going to compensate them for vacation time. That's going to add more. So I'm just wondering in terms of, are we at a rate of operators taking leave right now that is manageable, or is it higher than you would hope to have? Like, I'm just trying to understand the pressure of that as well.
You know, I think at this point, staff are doing a very good job of managing it. Obviously, there are challenges that we've talked about here today at the Transit Commission. You know, we need to move forward with that class that we're staffing for. That'll bring a little bit of relief, but we need to keep going. We need to keep moving forward on that. We do have a new schedule that starts in the beginning of January. That will provide some assistance, and that, you know, it's an opportunity for us to piece work together differently. Operators have now booked and selected their work, so we usually see at the beginning of a booking an improvement there as well. So, you know, we're managing it. I don't think it's a point where it's unmanageable, but you know, we do have the challenges, and that's what we've been talking about here today.
And just one more quick question, Blair Station. I'm very happy that the removal of the glass has added more space on the platform. I know, Mr. Manconi, you had mentioned that there's additional improvements that are coming. Have you determined what those are? I know there was difficulty identifying them, and what's the time frame?
No, Mr. Scrimger's job is to tell me if we need to do more there with the observations, and if you have views on that, because plan B would be to remove those shelters totally and then look at a cantilever type of covered system so that we have more space either there or across the board. So it's just incremental, and so I think removing the glass has helped things out. If we need to go further, we'll go further.
Do we have a time frame on when we might see some of those, say the cantilever or any of those items?
We're just waiting for the field observations. Pat, do you want to just comment on that?
There's, Mr. Chair, our teams have been working since before the train opened on possible enhancements across the system, possible physical enhancements at all parts of the stations. We're developing that list. We want to make that list big before we start to prioritize it or to cut it down into what should be done first and what's what's practical, what's affordable. So we're still building that list. Any suggestions about how to use the space we have at Blair Station are welcome. As John mentioned, we're certainly looking at the possibility of changing the sheltering system so that it cantilevers off the back wall on the south side, rather than being freestanding shelters. There is a limited amount of space. We're also working on a number of suggestions have been made from all kinds of sources, customers, operators, and some through councillors about moving individual routes. Councillor Tierney has the larger option of moving routes away from that station to Searville Station. We've talked about that. There's also the possibility to move some routes from within the fare paid zone over to the north side, so they'd be outside, so it would decongest the platforms, but cause an additional inconvenience to customers and put more pressure onto the one elevator in the system, which is historic and wasn't renewed with the project, or moving routes around between the stops on the south side. So we're trying to find a way, first of all, to move bus routes around between stops on the south side that relieves pressure on the platform without increasing pressure on the bus roadway, without bottling up the horseshoe turn at the west end, and certainly without making any additional difficulties to customers about, oh, I should go this way in the morning but this way in the afternoon, or, as Mr. Lamb talked about earlier, having two routes going to the same destination, leaving from different parts of the platform. Those are definitely things we want to avoid. So we're working on a plan that maybe we'll be able to ease things a little early in 2020 by moving bus routes around on the platform, and then we'll be looking at what are the capital projects that we can do during 2020 or start during 2020 with the funding that's available from council.
Okay. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you, Councillor Dudas. Commissioner Olson would like an opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Upon reflection, I want to say that my comment about my colleague, Commissioner Wright Gilbert, was not, I fear, taken as intended. I was merely citing what I thought was a well-known scientific fact that women typically do have a better sense of smell than men, and that this has been attributed to them having actually more brain cells than men. So if she was offended or misinterpreted somehow my remark, or if I miscommunicated it, I do apologize, but I do not apologize for the overall comment.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner Olson.
Chair.
Oh,
we need a fulsome apology. This is a half-baked apology, and we need a fulsome apology. Thank you.
We're getting way off topic here, so if you could make that a little more wholesome or fulsome for folks, that would be great.
Commissioner Wright Gilbert, I apologize.
Thank you, Commissioner Olson. All right, so next, Councillor Blay, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And just cognizant of the time, if you wanted to break for lunch, sure. I could keep my questions until after that. We have, obviously there have been a number of changes that have been needed to be made since the launch of LRT, and you know, additional buses, route changes, et cetera, the platforms, we got problems. Clearly there was some misjudgment or error or whatever you want to call it made during the modeling of everything that led us to the decisions that were eventually put into place. Given that we have detours for stage two that are going to begin sooner rather than later, and given your comments about the state of the workforce and their energy and how hard they've been working, et cetera, and our the challenges in bringing new operators on board fast enough because of training and the issues that you raised, how are we going to get the workforce out of this state before stage two opens? Because we've got four more years of construction and presumably a series of detours and changes over the course of the next 4 years.
That's a good question. So the January plan, when we were doing that, we focused on also the detours that come into place, Pat, in May. So we looked ahead on that also. So it's a two-step process. We need to land the January service change, and also we are looking ahead on, we looked at bus count, we looked at operator count. So the buses, for example, they're coming in. The detour buses are coming in on schedule, ahead of schedule. The operators, that's why we're not stopping on the recruitment. We're exceeding what we actually need, so we have a good buildup of operators. And the deal we did with the union certainly helps us create capacity on people saying they're not going to take a certain number of people not taking vacations during that period. And hence my unrelentless push of RTG in terms of, you know, that trend better continue on the rail service. And it has to continue, otherwise it causes us to do other things on the bus side of things. So we have looked at it. We're being proactive, and we're being very cautious in terms of numbers and ensuring on that. The detour routes on the stage one, stage two piece, that's been looked at. They are more straightforward than the stage one detours. Those are highly complex, as you recall, Councillor.
So, but even if the train gets to the absolute highest level of performance that we would expect, and you don't need the 20 buses on R1, can 20 buses in the general fleet make that big of a difference for some of the persistent issues we're hearing about in terms of capacity, about being on time, et cetera? And then if they're currently being paid for by RTG, presumably we'd have to pay for them to put them into service.
I'll get Pat to just talk about the detours, because actually your question's bang on in terms of, let's assume the 20 come off, what happens on the detour piece?
So, Mr. Chair, the first detour that starts this late this spring is the closure of Line 2 for its capital work. I believe that's 17 more buses that will be going on the road for that. Those buses are purchased and being manufactured, and some of the new operators that are being hired and trained will be for that. Over the next couple of years, we've got more detours, but they're also they're timed so that some of them come after this detour ends. So there, I don't have the numbers here of what the peak number of buses and operators are for when the east and west detours, I mean, the east detours are fairly self-contained. They're really just on the highway. It's really the west detours when the transitway closes, and when the transitway closes first south of Lincoln Fields and then later between Tunney's and Dominion. Those are the sections that cause us to need more buses, but it's nothing like the scale of what we had on stage one, where we in effect had about 75, I'm thinking, more buses between the 45 that we kept and the 30 or so. I don't have the numbers here with me, but much, much smaller scale with stage two.
Okay, and what's the lead time for the purchase of and to delivery of a bus?
It's between a year and a year and a half.
And so when you add our budgeting process on top of that, it's closer to 2 or 3 years, right? If we decided tomorrow that you needed to buy more buses, we can't approve the budget until September next year, October next year, I should say. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mr. Chair, there's also an opportunity, though, that we've been able to explore with we're participating in the joint procurement initiative that's been run by Metrolinx. So there's been times where we've been able to actually expedite the purchase of buses. We've been able to tag on to an end of an order, those types of things. So we do conservatively talk about a year to a year and a half, but we've been successful recently in getting buses built and delivered to us earlier than that.
Okay, and so in order to service a new route or a route extension, how many physical buses are required to do that?
We don't have that information here with us today. We can provide it later.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Merci, Conseiller Blais. Commissaire Caricato, s'il vous plaît.
Hi. Since you brought up the number 6, I have to ask, because that's the bus I use most of the time. I have noticed that it's always running late, and so I want to ask you, do we have a scheduling problem with that particular bus and others?
So Pat will explain the extra service that we're putting on there.
Mr. Chair, I would say we do not have a scheduling problem with the services on Bank Street. What we have is a reliability and consistency problem of the street operations. We need to schedule the service so that it accommodates a certain proportion of the variability, but we can never schedule it to accommodate all the variability. And Bank Street, possibly more than any other street in the city, has a great deal of variability. The biggest source of variability is in the afternoon rush hour, how the eastbound highway is working, the eastbound Queensway, and whether if the Queensway is backed up, the buses, the auto traffic that's going south on Bank that turns left onto Isabella to go up the ramp onto the highway, that backs up, and that'll back up all the way to Wellington if it's a bad, bad, bad day. Then there's also variability related to other activities that are going on or near the street further south. It's a busy street. It's an active street, the kind of street the city wants to have, where there's a lot of stuff going on, but it's not a predictable length of time from getting from one end to the other. We schedule, generally speaking, we will schedule to accommodate about 70 to 85% of all the variability that can occur. If we go too high, we end up making the buses very slow, and then they create their own congestion. If we go too low with that, we're disappointing customers far too much of the time. What we are doing for January is adding service so that service will be more frequent. On Route 6, we're adding 3 northbound trips, leaving Billings Bridge at just before 7:15 and just after 7:30, and we're increasing service between 2 p.m. and 3 p.m. in both directions. On Route 7, we're adding another trip going, or that's not a Bank Street section. Also on Route 7, we are increasing service between 2 and 3 in the afternoon from every 15 minutes to every 12 minutes. We're also continuing to do a number of things. We're continuing to look at a number of things right at this moment. If the meeting hadn't gone so long, I would have been meeting with Councillor Minar on two proposals we have to reduce travel time and improve reliability on the section of the route south of the Rideau River, on sections of both routes, 7 and 6. And so we'll move ahead with the councillor on those and further ideas as they come. It's a busy street. It's an active street, and it's a healthy urban street, but it doesn't lend itself to consistent travel times on bus service. Fortunately, however, many of the people who are traveling further south in the city aren't required to travel on Bank Street. If they're going south of Billings Bridge, council has in years past made that huge decision to build the transitway, which now connects with Line 1 at Herdman Station, so that all access to the south no longer funnels up Bank Street as it would have done before the 1990s.
Okay, glad to see there are some mitigating issues. I think what Mr. Manconi said, though, is that it's late just starting in the morning. So I understand traffic around rush hour later in the afternoon, but if the bus is already running late before it even leaves in the morning or the first round, is that not something we should address?
I'm guessing. Yeah,
sorry, Councillor, if that wasn't my intent. My intent was to basically say, Pat's done a very technical, there's a lot of traffic on Bank Street. The minute, I drive it all the time. I know people that live in your neighborhood, and they talk to me all the time about the 6. And I go, yeah, it's unreliable. Stuck in the same traffic that I'm stuck in. And you can talk to the planning department. There's been discussions about how do you make it better. And I'm not suggesting this. Do you want to do a dedicated bus lane there, get rid of the parking and so forth? The issue is we're trying to manage the expectations. That 6, the minute it hits Bank Street, is going to be late. He's increasing the frequency on that. It's not going to make it more reliable. There'll be more buses right there.
Yeah.
And I know you're in that area too, so I'm just being candid with you. The buses are late. We got lots of complaints about the 6.
I appreciate the candid comments. Do we have a scheduling problem citywide? Forget the number 6 for now.
What we have now is we have new data that's been coming in since the second week of October, which allows us for the first time to set schedules for the new routes based on reality, based on actual observations. All of the schedules that were placed into effect as of October needed to be based on either models of what would happen in the future, expectations of what would happen in the future, or an extrapolation from what had happened in the past to the future. There's not, in my opinion, there is not a problem with scheduling. There is, and the audit this year will help us to find if there are any systematic problems or systematic things that we should be doing differently. There is a new transit system in place, new bus routes that need to be scheduled based on measured data. And the process we use to turn those measured data into scheduled times needs to walk the balance between what is affordable and what is perfect, and that is all done by following the service standards which are set by the commission and by council.
Okay. Since you brought up affordability, I'm rereading some of the comments Mr. Manconi provided us after that article we read last week in the paper, in the Citizen. And you write, to put things into perspective is also important. 1 minute of recovery time across the system costs $1 million. Can you explain in detail where that figure came from and what it means?
Yeah, so the statistic there is a general statistic that we use. I mean, if we look at it, we do 8,600 trips a day. If you take the operator's wage rate divided by 60 to put it to a minute, 8,600 trips, times that 1 minute for that operator's wage rate times 261 weekdays, it comes out to a little over $1 million. So it's a general calculation we use. It doesn't include bus purchases or a potential increase in maintenance costs. It's just purely bus operator labor costs. But it just gives us that, you know, that high level indication that, you know what, you know, it's you can spend $1 million very, very quickly and have very, very small of an impact. So you need to, when we want to look at recovery time and running time, we want to make sure that we're inserting it in the areas where it is needed the most.
Okay. I think I'll pass to the next speakers.
Okay. Thank you very much, Commissioner. Councillor Suds, please.
Thank you very much, Chair. Most of my questions have been answered already via the numerous questions asked. However, just a couple I want to drill into. So one was actually Councillor Fleury's question that Councillor Leeper raised around geographic disparity on cancelled trips. And I know we had a conversation last week, specifically my concerns around 64. And you just mentioned now that, you know, you're going through some of that analysis. I think that would be useful, and that's something that I'll follow up directly with you on, is to get a better sense of that analysis, if only if that's so that we can convey the accurate information onto our residents. I think that would be very helpful. Another point that was raised around the new software. And my question there is, and I believe it was yourself, Mr. Scrimmager, mentioned that the core of it, the operational pieces, will begin to be rolled out next year. Can you talk to us a little bit about what this will actually mean to riders? When will they start to see or feel the impact of that software implementation?
I would say it'll be gradual, incremental, and probably fairly smooth. The first thing that will happen is that the controllers working in the TOCC will have a more modern, more robust, more reliable tool that they are using to monitor the system and to make decisions to improve reliability. So customers will definitely benefit from that improved monitoring and decision making and action taking, but won't notice it as a thing that occurred. It'll just be that, you know, that happened, but it's all behind the scenes. Later on, customers will see. When we have bus predictions that are based on times before the bus has started the route, customers will see it on the screen because they will see a green highlighted time on the OC Transpo app before the bus has actually left the terminal. When they see that, they will know that they're getting real-time data that is predictive from before the bus has actually started its route. Another thing that customers will actually see when we are able to turn on this feature is that when a bus is put on a very short detour or a short-term detour because of a fire truck or a road closure or something, and the bus has to go on another street, they will hear the announcements on the other street, when right now it just has to guess at what's the closest bus stop to where the bus is right now. So when the operators say, put this bus on a detour, they will get consistent bus stop information as they're on the detour. These are small things, but they're important things, especially for people who rely on those announcements. These are some of the things that people will see as the system first of all rolls out, and then as we integrate it better into all of our systems.
Do you have a sense of timelines as to when customers will actually see the change happening?
At this point, not precise. It was all on track. We needed to schedule it. We needed to make a decision a couple of years ago. Are we aiming to put this into use before the O-Train opens? or after the O-Train opens, because we weren't going to do it as the O-Train was opening. It was too much change at one time. So we made a good decision to hold this to after. When after was changed by a year and a quarter, year and a half, whatever it was. So we are now, my team will be giving me a recommendation to take back to discuss with my colleagues on what's the least risky time during 2020 to start to switch over to some of these new systems. And doing it, you know, obviously you'd want to do it at a point of stability, and maybe in early part of the new year we will have achieved that point of stability.
So am I hearing you correctly that it's ready to go? You just need to make a decision of when the best time is to start implementing?
I wouldn't go so far as to say it's ready to go. It's ready for us to make a it's almost ready for us to make a decision on what point we should be converging to.
Okay. Well, I will continue to ask those questions because I think, as you know, and I'm sure my colleagues can relate, there's frustration, obviously, among riders around not being able to see when that, or not being able to rely upon when that bus will arrive, and having those tools will really be impactful if they work well. One last question, and I'm asking this because it's come into me twice in this week alone, is with respect to smoking on the outdoor platforms. And this has come in as a concern, specifically Tunney's, both times. So I just ask, what is being done to enforce this, and what should riders be doing in a scenario in which someone is smoking where they should not be?
Like all city property, smoking is prohibited on city property, so including the bus platforms. As I mentioned earlier, we do have special constables that are out on the system, both, you know, on, we have dedicated special constables to the rail line, but as well as we have special constables that are driving around checking out bus shelters and platforms as well. If customers are seeing that, I'd ask them, you know, they can call it in to us, report it. If you know of some specific areas or some times, you can always reach out to me, let me know, and I'll ask our chief special constable to dedicate staff to those specific times and locations. But definitely we want to hear from our customers. If they're seeing that, observing that, and if they see any patterns, let us know, and we can dispatch staff to deal with that accordingly.
One of my residents had indicated they were told to tell a red vest. Is that an appropriate response?
The red vests are there. They do have access to provide information to our control room. So, I think at this point I'd say, you know, there's no wrong person to talk to. Okay. Let someone know. The red vest, the O-Train ambassadors, they know who they need to speak to, and they can get that information to that person, who then could take the necessary corrective actions.
Thank you. That's all.
Okay, thank you, Councillor Suds. Next up, Councillor Brockington.
Thank you. Round two will be briefer than round one, I promise. We're all hungry. We focused a lot on cancelled routes and the data that you're collecting on cancelled routes. What type of data do you collect on late routes, and what do you consider as late?
We collect data on the on-time status of every bus approximately every 30 seconds, sometimes more frequently than that. And we record all that data, and we keep that data for analysis, and then as time goes on, we sort of boil it down so we're not keeping the fine level of detail for years and years and years. We use those data, obviously, first of all, we use those data to provide on-time real-time predictions for our customers. The data that we see on our apps and on the screens and on the 560-1000 are all from that data source. We also use those data to see which, you know, just to do some very high-level calculations on which routes are doing okay and which routes need help, so that we can prioritize our more detailed scheduling and planning work to hit the ones first that most need the work. The busy routes that have the most variability or the most trips running early or late are the ones that we need to spend our time on first. And then you know go down from there so that we can organize our work. Those data on bus locations are also what we use in the huge analytical process that we have to set the running times for each segment of each route at each time of day. And we do that in a very fine level of detail.
Can I just jump in there, Pat? I want to share with you what my concern is. I think you have the data that you already need to make schedule changes. I don't think we need to wait for the Auditor General. He's going to take a year to do that audit, and then we're going to take another year to budget and plan the schedule changes that are needed based on whatever he recommends. So we're 2 years away. We went through a brutal winter last year. The service struggled to perform for the customers, and we can't go through that again this year. And that's why I'm shocked today to hear we don't have the required drivers that we need ready by the end of January. I thought that some are, maybe a quarter of the drivers will be ready, but we're stretching this out to June. And you are making some schedule tweaks, but I do think that global review of the 80% of the routes, I think that's the number I've heard in the past, that were changed back in October, needs to be done. And you have the data available. I don't know how you analyze that, but we just can't wait. So that's my fear. I acknowledge you're making some route or schedule changes in January coming, but again, it's we can't rely on whatever the Auditor General recommends to make more significant changes to the routes. This has to be, like, what are we expecting him to recommend that you don't have the data already at your fingertips to make schedule changes?
Well, I don't know what his scope is going to be. I haven't seen that yet. But the question that appears to be raised consistently is, do we have a scheduling problem macroly and at the root level? And what Pat has articulated many times is the schedules and the routes and the information he brings you are all in accordance with either council policies, and there's a bunch of them, and you went through a whole route optimization, you recall, in terms of that, in terms of walking distances and all those things. So he takes that, he applies that, and then he applies best practices. And you've often heard me say he's one of the best transit planners in Canada. Now, I will say that over and over again. Pat could get a job in just about any transit agency in North America. And his team do phenomenal work, and we use the latest technology and so forth. If it appears there is a concern that we need to do macro adjustments, and if you want to, there's different ways you do it. You can bring in the Auditor General to look at how we undertake that, and maybe there's gaps. Maybe we are doing things incorrectly and not in best practices or not following council policies. He can identify that. If you want us to bring back a policy report to make improvements across the entire system or consistently challenging routes, we can do that also. Yeah, we have tons of data. We've got lots of data. It's not about lack of data. But I'll be also candid. If nobody ever calls me and says, give me less service, it's give me more service, give me more reliable service, give me more information tools, give me more. And we are in conformance with council's policy, your transit affordability plan, the history that Councillor McKenney talked about, and all the previous decisions of, and I know some councillors and commissioners weren't here for those, but we're in accordance with all those policy decisions, including fare box recovery. And I'm glad somebody brought that up. We're at 50%. The goal is to go even higher. You know, you hear about free transit out in Minneapolis this week got announced. You know what their fare recovery is? 8 to 10%. So all they had to subsidize was $9 million. That's why they're getting free transit in Kansas City, or in Minneapolis, sorry. So there's a bunch of big policy things that are levers that you push and pull. Late buses, the previous reporting mechanisms that you've asked us to bring back a new scorecard was somebody picked 0 to 5 was a late bus. I asked the first thing months. I asked Mr. Scrimger, how did that discussion occur? What is that best practices? Is that industry standards? Is that achievable for a city like Ottawa that's got a BRT and on-street mixes? Those are the things we're going to bring to you on the performance reporting piece. But the Auditor General will answer, I think, the concerns that I'm hearing from some members of council. Do we have a scheduling issue? If you want us to come back and direct staff to come back with policy decisions to make service better and what that will look like and cost and so forth, and
little extra money to address little extra money to address little extra money to address all the issues that we raised. So I'm surprised that there are councillors who voted in favor of your budget who are asking for resources today, because that budget does not provide a lot of additional resources. We can tweak some routes. There is new money going into the system. But as we've seen, and will continue to see, it's not enough. And we have to reconcile at this commission the expectations with our public and the money that we have to meet those expectations, because right now they don't meet. And we have to either say to our public, we are going to provide the resources to meet those expectations, or we're not. It's one or the other, and we're not there yet. We continue to tell our public we're on your side, we're going to address these issues, but at the end of the day, we don't have a full complement of resources to match those expectations. And that's why I keep asking about your work plan, because I think this commission will see what the main objectives are. We will feed into that. Bus reliability is one of my main concerns. But at the end of the day, if we don't have enough resources, if it comes down to resources, that's what we have to wrestle with. And it wasn't anything more than resources that the rationale or the reasons why I voted against the budget, because I don't think we're being realistic and honest with the public when council supports a budget that will not meet the expectations of our traveling public. So I have other questions which I'll take offline, but the main one really for me continues to be the reasons that contribute to the bus reliability. We know it's a lack of drivers. You have a plan. I don't think it's fast enough. And scheduling, which I do think is an issue. I'll just mention in closing that it's hard to compare pre-LRT opening with the current situation, because it's two different data sets. The route changes that we made on October the 6th or 7th when they went in, you can't compare before that. And so there were some scheduling and route issues before, as I said many times, chronic issues in my ward. But even though they exist now, it's different routes. The routes have been changed, significant changes. So it's a subtlety, but the members of the public really don't care at the end of the day. They just need good service. And that's why we need to identify those causes and address them as soon as possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Brockington. Okay, so no other questions. We want to thank you, Mr. Manconi, and your team for the update. The commission, is the report received or the update received? Okay, thank you. There's no in-camera items. Notice of motions for consideration at subsequent meetings. Are there no? I believe Councillor Cavanaugh has one. You too? Okay.
Yes, Chair. I won't read the whole motion. I'll just read the therefore be it resolved, and it's related to the GPS service that in 2020 OC Transpo prioritized bringing forward a reliable GPS and user-friendly app system on buses to give accurate information on bus location and cancellations to transit users.
Okay, thank you. Councillor Brockington.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is on behalf of Councillor Fleury, who couldn't make it to the end, but and is not a member of the commission, so I'm reading this into the record as well. It's regarding sharing real-time data, and I will only read the therefore clauses at this time. Therefore, be it resolved that city staff develop the appropriate tools to create and share real-time data collection with the open data community by Q2 of 2020 without unreasonable delay and provide underlay of planned schedule. And be it further resolved that these developed tools allow city staff to create solutions for reporting metrics, including a client-centered focus, and resolve council's ongoing questions about transit. That's, again, moved on behalf of Councillor Fleury.
Thank you, Councillor Brockton. Mr. Manconi, that sums up basically what our reporting subcommittee is supposed to be doing, looking at all the options, all the metrics and everything. So is that better for you to do something with that? Is that better as a motion, or as a something we should maybe set aside and give to the subcommittee that's working on reports.
Yeah, I don't know if the two councillors had time to connect when I spoke to Councillor Flaherty. I recommended to him that he holds that motion till when we table our work plan, which has got the performance reporting in there, and then council can, or committee can debate that motion and other things if you want to tweak the work plan and so forth. That was my recommendation to him. Okay. He seemed to be okay with that. I don't know where that
landed. You okay with that, Councillor Brockington?
Just timelines, when would that be? When's your report ready?
It's Q1. We're hoping February, but sometime okay. Q1.
I will take that advice.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay, so.
I do have a public inquiry if we're there.
Yes, I believe. Oh, you have an inquiry as well?
Yes.
Okay, do you want to read your inquiry? And then Commissioner Olson has an inquiry as well.
Okay, thank you. I have written it out. If City Council decides to make significant design changes to LRT Phase 2 stations, what would the required process be to enact the desired changes? I'd like to table that inquiry.
So that would be FEDCO. They're taking all the design work and everything for Stage 2. We're only taking, once it becomes operational, it'll come to the Transit Commission.
Given that FEDCO won't meet until February, is there any way I can table this, get it on the record sooner rather than later, just because of the timelines for the...
Mr. Chair, if the inquiry is submitted today, any response would be placed on the FEDCO agenda at a future meeting.
That okay for you, Councillor?
Yes, but I would like some acknowledgement that OC's heard my question and maybe I can get answers before it's officially tabled at FEDCO, if that's possible.
It must be Christmas. You're asking for an awful lot. Mr. Manconi, are you okay with this, sir?
Oh, Mr. Morgan's going to have to work even harder, but yes, we will try, Councillor.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So, Commissioner Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I make an inquiry as well and a request a response at OC Transpo's earliest convenience. The inquiry is that for connection frequent and rapid routes serving either the Eagleson Park and Ride, the Fallowfield Park and Ride, or the Trim Park and Ride, broken down by individual bus routes serving each specific park and ride parking lot, no matter the time period, and for a period of 2 months before the really big service change in October, and separately 2 months after the really big service change, for each trip, the scheduled arrival time at each park and ride parking lot specified, for each trip, the normally assigned bus size, for each trip, the percentage of time during each reporting period that the normally assigned bus size for a trip was downgraded, i.e. from a double-decker to a 40-foot bus. For each trip, the percentage of time a trip was canceled for any reason. It's not necessary to specify the reason. And separately, the percentage of time a trip was late. Where data from infrared counters or other sources exist, the passenger load factor, that is the number of passengers as a percentage of capacity for the bus in service, for each trip upon its departure from the morning peak period or arrival at the evening peak period and other times, each park and ride parking lot specified. If such information is not available, please provide the average ridership and passenger load factor as available for each route for each reporting period. Also, for each route, any changes in normally assigned bus size for any trips or other changes in capacity, that is, addition or deletion of trips, that are being considered for implementation or which will be implemented either in December 2019 or January 2020. And the total number of complaints received by OC Transpo from any source for each reporting period about each connection route, frequent route, and rapid route serving each park and ride parking lot specified.
All the motions and inquiries to just remind everybody to submit them to our clerk in writing, please. Okay, is there any other inquiries? Nope. Okay, no other business. Can we have a motion to adjourn?
Adjourn.
Motion to adjourn. Thank you. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays to everybody. Our next meeting currently will be Wednesday, February 19th, 2020. Hope you all see you all in the new year.